Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Newly released collections feature brand new shirts for Rob Zombie's Three from Hell, as well as the new Halloween classic, Josh Hastie's Candy Corn. Stay tuned next Wednesday, September 25th, for our 10th anniversary Saw collection, featuring a new shirt, socks, and wax pack trading cards with autographs by Tobin Bell and Shawnee Smith randomly inserted. All officially licensed and available exclusively at fright-rags.com. Listeners get 10% off their first order with the code WAVES10. Again, that is 10% off by using WAVES10 at fright-rags.com.
Okay, welcome to episode 160 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galluzzo.
Survived 160. How you doing?
Barely.
160.
This will not be the last episode of Shockwaves ever.
How do you know that? We just started.
I'm an optimist.
Elric's drinking out of a Best Actor nominated coffee mug.
Oh, God. I don't know.
Things you find at the Blumhouse offices.
Yeah,
that's Elric Kane, and that's also Rebecca McKendry.
Hello.
Who does not have the fancy mug.
I don't. Mine's disposable, so killing penguins.
All right.
Yeah.
Great. Wow, that's going to be hashtag everything at Becca, killing penguins.
Killing penguins.
That's what she wants to be known as.
I think it's styrofoam.
A joke, audience at home. That is not serious.
I have problems killing spiders. I actually don't kill spiders.
Becca,
so.
You're canceled, please.
I'm canceled right now.
You've already been canceled.
You've been canceled.
Yeah. But guys,
you're old news now. And now she's back. It's a comeback trip. Cool.
She's canceled,
really,
and she'll
quick.
Be a host on Saturday Night Live before you believe it, before you know it. Welcome. Let's see. Before anything, we just walked into a package from our friend Jimmy Gonzalez, who is Space Tunes. T-O-O-N-Z on Twitter.
Out of Vegas.
And he does this really cool thing. I have a couple of these collections already, but this one's called Last Night a DJ Took My Life, which is a Blu-ray that features footage and trailers from all these great giallo movies, and he mixes the music together. So it's kind of like, to me, this is like the fun sort of thing you would put on in the background at a party.
Yes.
Or it should be playing at a bar,
mm-hmm.
preferably with the soundtrack on, which is kind of neat. But he does these collections. They're really excellent. And thank you for sending us some copies of it. It's actually available today on Diabolic DVD and Two-Headed Dog, which are two of our friends.
And he's a DJ, and you can book him. So please look him up. Jimmy Gonzalez.
Yeah.
I always judge
teams.
Anything giallo-ish if it has Strange Vice of Miss Ward and Spasmo.
And it does. It's got them both. Yeah,
it's got it's actually a great list of films.
Yeah. This is tight, guys.
So I will see clips of this and I will hear cool music.
Yep.
Very cool.
But it doesn't stop. It's all continuous. It's like, it's literally like a DJ set.
Yeah.
But with,
awesome.
But set to like the trailers and the actual films. It's
That's
pretty
totally
cool.
Rad. Yeah.
So thank you for sending us those.
Yes.
You guys should definitely check it out. Last Night a DJ Took My Life.
Yeah. And a nice reminder for people to send us stuff.
You're canceled, Elric. You've been canceled.
We're big fans. Yeah, we're fans of free stuff. So, how was everyone's weekend?
I went to Monsterpalooza with both my kids and Elric and his kid.
One kid.
But you guys went on what, Sunday? Because
we went on Friday night.
Yeah, tell us about Friday because it was not that busy on Sunday. Like, it was busy to walk around, but it didn't feel crazy.
It was very chill.
Yeah.
It was a very chill show.
It was pretty chill on Friday night. Saturdays was already sold out. And so just so people know, in Halloween season around mid-September, they always do Son of Monsterpalooza. So this one's a much smaller version of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel like this is what really kicks off the Halloween season for me because we start bumping into everybody we know and start making plans for things. So this is the smaller one that takes place in Burbank. The much bigger one is, I think, in March or April
in Pasadena,
yep.
which is just monstrous.
Yeah.
Literally.
I definitely was missing the museum.
Well,
I was just
done.
Telling you all.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I didn't know what the difference was. I just assumed it's slightly smaller, but I definitely the museum. If you ever make it out to LA for a convention, this is the one to come out for.
The one early in the year is definitely the absolute one to travel here for.
Yeah,
it's very special. And again, it's because it's an effects based convention that celebrates practical effects all the effects houses are here in Los Angeles. So they usually contribute some cool stuff that's around their studios over to the museum, which is basically a giant room they can walk through and see cool props.
Yeah, and it really is an industry show. Like, it feels like an industry show. So it feels different from any other horror convention that you've been to. There are guests, but those definitely are not quite as big of a show as kind of the effects house wheeling out all of their props and old stuff. And you'll walk through and find entire sets from old horror films and things like that. So it's just, it's really a sight to behold.
Yeah, I got starstruck by the non-horror, because, you know, horror people now, we've kind of met everyone or seen everyone.
Yeah.
But I walked, as soon as you walked in the door, Nick Stahl, who I've always said is like my favorite.
Yeah.
I've always said he's my favorite young actor. He's probably older than me at this point. But, you know, he was that yellow bastard. But
it was
In the Bedroom and Bully. I remember seeing them right around each other when I was, you know, they're much more pure cinema titles, but they blew me. Like, I was like, this is the greatest actor of this generation. Obviously, he had his run-ins with drugs and some issues along the way, but just even seeing him, I was like, oh my god, he's like a major star. Well, yeah.
We walked over to the other building, and I took my three-year-old, and so Marnie and Keaton like stuck together and they're hanging out the whole time, but my three-year-old just kind of is doing his own thing and running, and when you have a three-year-old, they fall over a lot and kind of stumble around, and he was running, and then all of a sudden he almost ran into this very tall person, and he looked up kind of starstruck, and I came in and swooped up and was like, sorry about that, and took him away. And as soon as I moved out of the way, Elric goes, your son just ran into Billy Zane.
I was like, that was Billy Zane, and he even had weird hair. I've never seen him not bald. He's kind of grows out to the side. Yeah. I was like, Demon Knight.
That's pretty cool.
But yeah, like, some of the art was cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I just went Friday night and I walked around, and, you know, obviously they have makeup demonstrations going on, and it was pretty good. I didn't buy much. Our friends from Cavity Colors were there, so I bought the Trick or Treat shirt that I'm wearing right now.
Oh yeah, we stopped and talked to them. Neat.
I didn't realize fun side story. Just showing how long we've been doing this and bringing people together. Devin Whitehead, who almost exclusively does all the Cavity Color stuff, and as of late has been doing a lot of Scream Factory covers, including the Trick or Treat shirt is his Trick or Treat cover for the Scream Factory thing. I didn't know that Aaron Crawford, who runs Cavity Colors, met Devin through me.
Oh, wow.
It was because I wrote an article about him for the Blumhouse website. Uh-huh. And he just thought his work was so cool that he reached out to him. And now he's like almost exclusively doing all these incredible.
And they're both listeners, right?
And yeah, Devin did the poster for my movie as well,
which I found him
through Shark Exorcist, because I saw the poster for that movie. And I was like, I don't know about this movie, man, but that poster is epic. And I immediately was like, who did this? And hunted him down. And yeah, it's a great poster. Look it up.
Shark Exorcist. Yeah, I saw Aaron and said hi. And then the first thing I said is, do you have any of the Street Trash ones? He's like, long out of print.
Oh.
I just woke up one day realizing I have no Street Trash t-shirt. What's wrong with me? Everyone should have a Street Trash t-shirt.
I had a really old one that Mondo did.
I think I remember that design 10 years ago.
It was super like Dayglow on a white shirt, and I spilled spaghetti sauce on it, and it was just tragic.
I just want those crazy feet that are all like fucked up with the no ankles, like it's just the feet. But anyway, Aaron's he's great. I love him.
I ended up purchasing 3 Mad Balls because I took children instead of going for myself, so I got to do no shopping. But
isn't it cool that that's still popular?
Like, I know. Something that we like as kids. The coolest thing.
It's still the coolest thing there was Mad Balls.
Well, yeah, it made a comeback.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I believe they make them as like the movie Maniacs as
Marnie,
Mad Balls now.
Because Marnie, they met the Predator there. The kids, there was this little kid Predator walking around who scared them, and then Marnie growled at him, and then he bowed in submission. And I was like,
crazy.
This kid knows the Predator. He's good.
But you say that, and this is what was so kind of cool about it. They had like a Jason one, like, you know, the Mad Balls are all, but instantly the kids both went to the horned guy who was popular when
original.
We were kids.
Yep. Yeah.
And I was like, I love it when people are just, there's just some power to original things. You know?
Well, Marnie already has Oculus, Orbis, and Strummer has Skull Face.
Classic,
yeah, Marnie has the eye one and Strummer has Skull Face. So we had to get new ones.
And we're obviously working on a sponsorship deal for the show.
Yeah, Mad Balls. What up?
Madball, speaking of, I swear this is not a sponsorship, but my life has been changed by a streaming service, if you will. So, of course, I go physical all the way if I can.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for you to say Fandor.
No, this is not Fandor. Sorry.
Night Flight? No, not even Night Flight.
It's a hub for all these things. So I got a Roku device.
I love my Roku.
FYI, before you continue, I didn't have one either for the longest time. And about a year or two ago, one of our listeners gave me their Roku. Well, Jacob, I can't always butcher, does the comic book artist.
Jacob Shahan, Davidson.
I'm going to butcher your last name. Sorry, Jacob. He also gave me the valid. He's at Trivia all the time. You've met him.
Yeah, sure.
Times. Anyway, so I have a Roku because of our listeners.
Oh, my God. I love it because, well, I mean, because I run everything through my Blu-ray player, which is a Sony device, which in essence is just a PlayStation without the PlayStation. And unfortunately, they don't have an HBO app. They got rid of Hulu because of some deal. And you can't add apps to it. So I was like, you know, I kind of want to see other things. And so my old roommate was just like, here. And he showed me a link. It's like $30 for a Roku Express. You plug it into the back of your HDMI cable and your TV. And then you load up all the apps and just log into everything. But here's why it's such a revelation to me. I've always subscribed to Shudder through Amazon. And on Amazon, there's a few things. Shit. There's a delay. It's really difficult to find stuff. There's a delay. You can't watch anything live, etc. Subscribing directly to the Shudder app is amazing.
Right? It's so much. You get all the shorts.
Everything's up. I love that it's live. There's three live stations all at once. So, like, yesterday, for no rhyme or reason, I was watching Madhouse because it was on. You know? And then, yes, this morning, I just put it on and it was like the ending of Slumber Party Massacre 2. And I'm like, yes, sure.
Isn't it? It is so exciting that something's just on.
Yeah.
It's a great. I sometimes look at it on my phone.
Yeah, that's why. So to just pick it.
That's why I originally got the Roku is. When I used to work in an office, this is actually at the Fango office in New York, we always had CNN on in the background. And I got so used to kind of working with some type of TV on in the background. And I don't know why. We had a TV in like the main office of the Fango New York office. And it was always playing like C-SPAN or occasionally ESPN or CNN. And I got so used to it. And then I got really frustrated because I didn't have anything on in the background. And you can watch live television with your Roku through the apps. So I now watch CNN again. There's some really cool apps. I recommend the Night Flight one, which I've mentioned before, but they not only have most of the Arrow, Blue Underground, and a lot of the Severn titles, they also have all the Something Weird on there.
Yeah, which is cool.
And those are some of my favorite ones to just throw on in the background because I may not be able to sit down and watch them all start to finish 100% focused on them, but I can totally throw them on in the background and completely enjoy them. So
our listeners literally think it's 2012. We just discovered Roku.
I saw a thread on in the group asking about what are great apps, whether free or otherwise. And for example, I just subscribed to Shout TV, which is Shout Factory's app. It's pretty great. I mean, it's not a tremendous selection. I mean, it's all the Mystery Science Theater stuff.
It's worth it alone for the Decline of Western Civilization because they have all three on there. And I'd never seen the Gutter Punks one until I was like, well, it's on here. I might as well watch it.
Yes, the cool thing is at any given moment, it's like, I don't know, 25 to 50 titles. Not a lot, but it's free. There's like two or three ads that pop up. But it's the HD transfers of stuff from the Corman Library. Saturday the 14th is on there right now.
I don't know if it's still on there, but it was a couple years ago. I've never watched it. Only one time when I was at a friend's house, and I watched Fear City by Ferreira that way.
Oh, wow.
And it was really cool. First time I'd seen it, and that's a really fun movie. So
yeah,
it might still be on there. I don't know.
So I don't know. I'm all in on Roku. I still prefer physical, just saying. But it's pretty cool to have it all at your fingertips. And I'm catching up on stuff on HBO. I'm going to probably subscribe to the Criterion Channel.
Struck app is still there.
I didn't even think about the Criterion Channel. Yeah. You guys know this week I really wanted to show Peeping Tom the horror class that I'm teaching at Studio School. I'm doing a horror class at the school that Elric runs this semester. And I wanted to show Peeping Tom when I teach 1960s. And I looked it up to buy it. It's $170 for the fucking DVD now. Yeah. I went on a crazy search, and then Elric ended up finding a copy, but I didn't even think to check the Criterion app.
I wonder why that's not on Blue in America.
I don't know, but because they did a really great restoration that I have, but it's a UK disc,
one.
And it's Region B, so you can't play it on a regular player here.
It'd make a good documentary. I mean, I'm sure there's a good doc about how it basically ended his career.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, Scorsese's on the disc because he's basically the one that rediscovered it.
Yeah.
Right, and then helped get it out. He married Scorsese's editor, Thelma
Michael
Schumacher.
Powell?
They ended up married together.
Get out of here.
Yeah, really?
He was like 30 years older than her, but they started meeting through Scorsese and everything.
Whoa.
And they had a big romance. It was like the love of her life, like later in life. And they were together till he died. It was like kind of one of those like, oh, cool, cinema.
I didn't know that part.
Cinema.
Wow.
Amazing.
That's a cool side
story,
man.
That's why you come here.
Yeah. Well, for things like Shudder and like Criterion, instead of doing the monthly thing, I just want to do the one shot. Like here's $100 for the year or whatever it is.
That's a good commitment.
But I'm going to – you need to separate it. Because if you do it all at once, then all of a sudden next year you're like, oh man, I've got all these apps like whatever. But like if you spread it out, then it's like, oh yeah, that thing, I had an extra $100 for January.
I just haven't
January,
had the time you know? For Criterion yet, even though it's all the stuff I want.
Don't like, you own all of those? You have like have a room a full.
I have a lot of stone plastic sleeves.
But it's still not enough.
I got in a lot of trouble with our some listeners for leaving them in the plastic sleeves.
They do.
Fine.
It's like mint in box Blu-rays.
Like
and
way.
I'm like, why?
Rob knows why. Because the day that I watch that on the Criterion channel and it fucking freezes, I can just go, oh, I've got
I have
a
it.
Nice
Boom.
Plastic sleeve.
Boom.
Yeah. No, I get it. After my plight trying to find Peeping Tom this week, I get it. But I am, I'm intrigued to see how all of these different VOD channels kind of tease out and how everything shakes out, because it was just, okay, Netflix is dominating the market, but even just this year, we've got Disney Plus coming.
It's
and
the only
then,
reason I got a Roku, Disney
yeah,
Plus.
I mean, I have to get Disney Plus. Like, yeah. My kids will literally, like,
but,
wither
so what
if
will
I don't.
Be on there besides
but,
the Disney movies? Is
well,
there new
Marvel,
content?
Star Wars.
Everything Marvel, everything Star Wars, everything Disney, everything Pixar, all 30 seasons of The Simpsons, because Fox is now part of that deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's
massive.
A game changer. Yeah. It's a lot.
And then even, but just this week, NBC announced that they're doing their own VOD channel as well called Peacock. And so like everyone's kind of trying this, and I'm interested to see like who is able to make a go of it. I'm still watching like, you know, Quibi is really trying to make a push in the horror world as well with some of the content that they've been curating.
Whoever
so.
Gets NYPD Blues owns the marketplace.
that's all
I always say. If you get Caruso, it's like that's all you need is Caruso.
That's it.
Yeah. Take those sunglasses off. They didn't
well,
get those in that show, but still.
In addition to critiquing the current VOD system, I also did the Q&A for the Riot Girls screening on Friday night.
Oh,
this
right.
is Ivanka Vukovic's new film. I won't say that it's 100% horror, but I will say it's incredibly brutal and graphic. And very cult. The tone is
like
not.
Teen cult.
Yeah, it's like teen cult. It is like a teen cult movie, kind of like 1984-ish, I'll say, or like, sorry, Class of 1984, yeah. or Summer Camp Massacre. But at the same time, it's got a lot of comedy to it as well, and really, really intense gore and brutality.
And lots of progressive ideas.
Yeah, really progressive ideas. It definitely. I would call it a queer film that kind of emerges midway through. But yeah, it's a post-apocalyptic world where, and they really, really brush over this. You get like 10 seconds of it at the top. Post-apocalyptic world where some type of stomach illness kills off all the adults. And so all of the kids of the world have to run everything by themselves, and it really does turn into like a Lord of the Flies environment. And the whole setup is basically Warriors, where within one town, there's kind of these two divisions, east side and west side, with the kids. And the east siders are from the poorer communities, and they're scrappy punk kids, whereas the west siders are from the really affluent communities. And so they rule with an iron fist, but everything's still very clean and manicured and well-maintained over there. And somehow one of the East Siders gets trapped and imprisoned on the West Side. And so a gang of the punk kids have to go over through the West Side to try to save him and get him back before they kill him. And so it really is set up like Warriors, but with teenagers and highly brutal and a lesbian couple as your protagonists.
Yeah, I think if I was 15 and I'd turned the TV on, I would have really dug it. Like, it's not that I didn't dug it, but I definitely felt a little old for what I was, for just personally. Like, mm-hmm. I can watch kids' things with kids, but there was something when it's teen orientated, it's a little harder for me to access. But yeah, no, it's well made. That's the thing. And it's funny because going there, I was sure I'd heard of a comic book called or a graphic novel called Riot Girls. So I went
There's
and going.
There's Paper Girls.
Yeah, it must be that. But I went and going, oh, is this an adaptation? And then it opens with comic book panels. So I was even more thinking.
It's
that,
not.
And it's not.
I thought it was.
And she
no,
just made
wow.
up the comic panels were just part of the
yeah,
post-production.
Yeah, they're just part
but
of.
But it really did my head in because I was sure I had yeah. heard of this before.
Yeah, I asked Ivanka about it in the Q&A and she said that the comic book aesthetic was more of used for transitional because you were bouncing back and forth between kind of the backstory and then all of these different protagonists on the different sides of the town. So they used it as kind of like a transitional thing to fold you back and forth between the different stories. And it works really well. But yeah, it made me say, oh, this is based on a comic book. And no, it's not. This was an original story. So yeah.
That's good for her though, because it is more teen and it's way more new. The Q&A was actually really good because she was just like I had to way restrain myself. Like I want to go crazy hard. And she just had to pull all the way back. There's a couple of cool gore scenes, but she definitely said her next thing, you know, she's pushing
She wants to go
full hard. So So it's, you know, it was interesting.
Had I been 15, though, as a huge horror fan, this would have hit every sweet spot. Like, it's politically progressive. It's gory. It feels off the hook. It's Lord of the Flies-ish. Yeah. It's very anti-authoritarian. And it's got a great punk score the whole time. So, yeah, it's definitely a fun little film.
Yeah.
Cool.
I chased that with the next day, Hellraiser 3 and Hellraiser 4.
Whoa.
I like Hellraiser 4.
A friend of the show, Luke Petrowski, who's been on the show once before, he had just finished watching 1 and 2 again. And you know, I've seen them a million times. And I realized I haven't seen 3 in quite a long time and had fun with it. I thought, you know, 3 is still fun. It holds up. It was a little goofier than even I remembered. Like,
Don't say that. Okay. What am I saying? It's totally fucking goofy. It's fun, though.
One of the things I realized about Pinhead is I don't like seeing him move. Like, I just made a comment. It's like, when he moves, it's just silly. Like, he should only ever pop up places and be still.
Well, I mean, for most of the movie, his body is kind of encased in the obelisk and only his head's sticking out.
That's pretty damn funny. And the AJ guy who runs the bar, you know, the bar is pretty ridiculous.
J.P. Monroe.
That's why I'm so bad at horror.
He's like a legend.
Yeah, that guy, he's sexy.
I actually looked him up right after, and he has gone on to be a very successful screenwriter, mostly, you know, straight to video type movies. But there was one movie in there that was actually, like, you know, pretty decent.
Googling
and he looks, he actually looks better. I think he's better looking now because he's definitely a gray wolf looking guy now, less of a fratty asshole. But
I would never consider J.P. Monroe fratty.
He looks like, oh, God, I thought he was. I mean, I guess I don't know what a frat, you know.
Kevin Bernhard.
Yeah. Yeah, Bernhard. The Peaceful Warrior was one that I remember getting good reviews. I think that's one of his. But anyway, I had fun watching it, but I loved the scene in the church. I thought that's like that's just so beautifully done. The direction's really fun, but the one thing I said straight away, and both Luke and I said almost the exact same time, is like, man, this is like a Sam Raimi movie. Like, the camera is always pushing in on things, and it's the guy who did
Waxworks,
which
Anthony Hickox made
total sense afterwards. So I hadn't seen that in a long time. I enjoyed it, but I had really bad memories of 4 and had only seen it when it first came out on VHS. So we're talking a long time ago. And I always remember, you know, it's an Alan Smithy film. I remember Kevin Yeager had kind of graduated from effects to get to do this one film, and he wouldn't agree to go back and do the reshoots, so somebody else came on.
Joe Chappelle off of Halloween 6.
Right, off Halloween 6.
Yeah, I have to say, I kind of enjoy.
Look,
I kind of like it too.
I got to say, I kind of enjoy, on rewatching them back to back, I maybe enjoyed this one more, largely probably because I was less familiar with it.
Yeah.
But it's just so bonkers, you know, the time shift.
Yeah, Pinhead through time.
Yeah, yeah. You start him trying to make a space trap, and that's the framing story is, you know, the ancestor who's now like, you know, cyberpunk type guy.
Yeah.
And then it cuts back to, what's the original guy's name? Leviathan expert.
Frank.
Who's the original guy who creates the box, the toy maker?
That would be Lamar Chance.
Yeah, you're the right person for this.
No problem. This
is my phone a friend.
That's why I'm here.
She has a whole podcast dedicated to this story. Anyway, what I didn't like about his storyline is that he just designs it as a toy based on somebody else's spec and then gives it to them, and then they do some sort of evil ritual. And I'm like, I don't know if the guy who made this, I think he should have been a little more implicated in what this design opens up. Like, that felt a little like a mistake there, but it's what's his name, Adam, who's the comedy actor from everything in the last 20 years, Adam Scott. Is that Adam Scott?
Oh.
Adam Scott's the main guy.
I haven't even paid attention to that.
He's like the assistant. This is her first film.
Wow.
So it's super goofy seeing him with a long wig. He's like the, you know, the henchman who goes on to be the main. I'm pretty sure it's Adam Scott. Adam Scott, yeah. And I was very surprised to see that. It's cool when they do. But what I really liked is I like this the incantation that they bring about is Angelique, this demon. And I found that to be really interesting because she is summoned in a totally different way. It's not related directly to the box. She seems different than Pinhead, from like almost a different demon lineage. And I think where they start to make a mistake in this movie is where it feels a little rushed. Once Pinhead shows up, it takes a bit of the air out of her tires and it makes her a little subservient to him. And I feel like that's where it went wrong. If it could have restrained on Pinhead a little more like the first one and let her really shine, because I found her to be really compelling. She reminded me of Noomi Rapace as an actress. It had a similar look. I was really into that stuff and the kind of weird sexy demon. She's going around doing all this bad stuff throughout the ages. And then you get most of the movies in the current time period where the guy – the architecture building that is set up at the end of 3 is really delivered upon, and you know they have more work for the box. But again, once Pinhead starts moving around and chasing you, there's a little silliness. There's weird twins whose heads can join.
I love those. The Wired Twins.
There's a moment that reminded me of a certain movie we reviewed very recently of a new director very recently. That's all I'm going to say. That there's a moment where it's like, it was almost exactly the same kind of effect. I'm dropping it for the ones who have a short attention. I liked this one
because it explored the mythos a lot more than a lot of the other ones do. Because prior to this, I mean, the focus was always just on Pinhead. Yeah. And after this, the focus kind of goes back to Pinhead and just, you know, whatever we can do, let's do it. Just stick Pinhead in there somewhere. But this one really does start to delve into the mythos a lot more. Like that architecture stuff is in some of the original stuff. And a lot, it's in a lot in the comic books. And so I was really excited to see the architecture come through in the movie. And the box, kind of the whole construction of the box and everything.
To contain light. I had never heard that part of it before. Like how the whole design was about keeping the light.
That is a little bit straying from the mythos. When it's originally created in the books, it's created as a music box. And I always talked, if you listen to the Nightmare University that I do just on the Hellraiser mythos, it was originally created as a music box. And I was always sad that they kind of shied away from that.
Did it have music play?
It had a motif that would play with it. But it was not a functioning music box. And I always want to know what the lament configuration would sound like. That sounds like such a cool thing. Originally, that was supposed to be the most enticing thing that would keep people going is as you would move it around, it would continue to play music. And so that kind of became the thing. But that said, they did play a little bit with the box and the construction and going back to Lamar Chand in 4, which I loved.
Yeah, these things get a little like, oh, quickly grab the box. He's walking towards you. And if you just touch the box, suddenly the light comes and kills him. I feel like it became too easy for them. Like they needed to make it. And it was the actress who looks like Meryl Streep from Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Oh, Kim Myers.
Yeah, she's really good, but I always feel bad because she has bad taste in men. No, both movies. they felt like sequels. It felt like when she got older, she married this bozo, and then her life really went off the rails.
Now, I remember that this one, it got terrible reviews at the time, and it's always been kind of disparaged as, oh, Pinhead in space. Yeah. And I can see that because that was kind of around the same time that we were like sending Leprechaun to space and things like that.
But then you get to the next 3 or 4 or 5.
I know, and I still say 4 is the last sensical plot. And I mean, I do come to the defense of Deader all the time, but I don't.
Is that Derrickson's one? Because that's a fun movie.
Derrickson's Inferno.
Deader was another one, and it was also written by somebody who's like really a good screenwriter. I can't remember who.
But the problem is that Bloodline is the last legitimate Hellraiser sequel.
Yeah, Barker, last one he was at all involved.
Well, not just Barker, just a Hellraiser sequel. Everyone after that, maybe even Derrickson's, is another script the Weinsteins got and were like, yeah, can you rework this to put Pinhead in there somewhere?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So they're not Hellraiser movies. They're
but not Fat Pinhead. That was like part of the legacy.
Wait, what?
No, you want to hear the saddest thing? As soon as the movie ended, I started looking up Fat Pinhead on GIFs, and there wasn't a single GIF of Fat Pinhead. I was so disappointed. I was like, what? How does somebody not GIF the shit out of that?
Has anyone seen the last one? I did.
Gary Tunicliffe's.
John Gulliger playing... The note taker, but he's like the guy taking their confessions. That part was actually pretty. The confessional thing was really interesting.
I have
the
to say,
the plot isn't good.
The plot, the it's really kind of noir-y cop plot. But that said, Gary Tunicliffe, he got it more than I think a lot of the others did. Like considering a lot of the subsequent sequels that we've had over the past 10 years, I have to say Gary Tunicliffe definitely put forth a good effort.
He did
effort.
The effects on
a lot of them.
I was just talking about
yeah.
that, but Inferno.
He did most of them.
Yeah.
He designed the boxes going forward. And if you actually go to his effects house anytime, he literally has a briefcase full of all of the boxes from all the different movies. And he'll show you like what they did. And this one was made to just do this because there was no set box. They each had to like do one thing and then it would cut to another box. But no, it's got some interesting stuff to it. He definitely tries to go back to the mythos a little bit, but he tries to do it in kind of a contemporary neo-noir environment. And there's parts that don't work, but I do appreciate the most out of most of the sequels that have happened over the past couple
years. Hellraiser Cyber Cafe is not a good movie. the one with Lance Henriksen at the end, that is one of those ones I remember watching going, wow, like now it culminates in people at a cyber cafe. Yeah. It's like, nope, dated. Wow. But anyway, yeah, no, it's fun to revive. I would say check out Inferno. I thought it was pretty fun.
Mm-hmm. No, it's
Bloodline.
Bloodline.
Right? Yeah, that's one.
Yeah. I always enjoyed that one. So I watched Seventh Victim, which I have seen before, but I was showing it in a class and I sat down and rewatched the entire thing start to finish.
Really one of my favorite of all the Val Lewton producers.
Yeah, and that's what I was getting ready to say is I do have to say, you know, I'd always kind of adhered to like Cat People and some of his more well-known stuff, but I do have to say I think Seventh Victim is my favorite one of his. It feels so different from everything else that we were seeing at the time, but in the same vote, it kind of falls into everything else that was going on in this kind of late 1940s, where it's got this kind of noirish mystery going on, where this woman arrives in New York City. And she's trying to figure out where her sister is. She hasn't heard from her sister in forever. And her sister's not at the business that she owns. She sold the business and she's no longer at her apartment. And instead, she's renting this other place that when they open it up, the only thing in there is a single chair and a noose. And they know that her sister has always struggled with depression. And the guy who she's supposed to be marrying has no idea where she is. And you quickly find out that she's become involved with a satanic suicide murder cult in Greenwich Village. And so,
quite classy.
Yeah, and it's a really, really like classy upscale murder cult.
Kind of ties into Rosemary's Baby quite well in terms of the kind of people. Mm-hmm. But the movie, I mean, I remember when I first saw it, I instantly thought you pair that with Suspiria as a perfect double feature.
It feels like it.
Because there's just a feeling that they both have. And I think you can tell Argento was really influenced by Cat People because they're in the swimming pool scene. If you watch the swimming pool scene of Suspiria, it's exactly shot almost exactly the same as the Cat People swimming pool scene. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is an influence because the way Luden's using shadow and darkness, Argento kind of uses color.
Yep.
Like with these big pools that are almost noir in a sense, but light and color. It's weird.
So yeah, this whole one, absolutely beautiful. Just the sets, the exteriors, and it's a slow burn. Like I dare to say that some of the freshmen in the class were a little like, God, this black and white film's been going on forever. I think it's only 81 minutes long, but it is kind of a slow paced little boiler of a mystery as you're trying to figure out what's going on with her. Ending, I still never believe. It's one of those movies where no matter how many times I watch it, I always am still kind of a little like, I can't believe they ended it that way.
It's one of the bleakest films.
Very bleak.
Where it goes. But yeah, this is one that, because like luckily we've Scream Factory or Shout Factory have been releasing a lot of, mm-hmm. like Curse of the Cat People got released. If this one gets released, I think it will get a major bump in, you know, I just don't think people know too much about this one.
Yeah.
It hasn't been that available. I only saw it through TCM. Back in the day, and that was then the reason. Yeah. So
I also showed them the last segment of 1942's Dead of Night, the ventriloquist dummy, and that they were just like hollering during. So dummies have always been scary.
Yeah.
So
that's for damn sure. The one I'm really excited to talk about, and I'm not sure when the last time you saw this is Argento. Is always hard to just rediscover an Argento, and I had totally written this one off back in the day. Like I remember going, it's okay. But I was disappointed because I thought it was going to be great. And I rewatched for the first time Sleepless. And I'm pretty sure it's getting a Blu-ray treatment.
Somebody's doing it.
I think they are. And
like Red Scorpion or one of those.
Yeah. But I'm here to tell people, get excited about this. I've been hitting that the video rental at Draft House because I work nearby. And so they have a lot of these out-of-print things. And I just was like, you know, I've been wanting to rewatch that one for a long time. It's Max von Sydow, which is why I remember being super excited back in the day because it's Max von Sydow and Argento. And it is really a really straight ahead, full-on Argento giallo slasher. It's a real return to what he did best. Is it quite at that level? No. And it's got a goblin score. But it's basically 17. It's set 17 years earlier. There's been a kid witnesses a brutal murder of his mother, I believe. And like there's a flute going into the skull. I mean, it's crazy. Max von Sydow talks to the person and says, I promise if it's the last thing I do, I'll solve this murder. Cuts to 17 years later and the killer has been dormant. There was, you know, serial killings. And it opens with this really intense, very edgy, lots of nudity, just crazy scene of a prostitute talking to, like, in perfect Argento fashion, someone who you don't see who's undercover, kind of grunting and making noises. And she's like, this is just too fantastic, too strange. It's too perverse. And then you're like, all right, now I'm watching Argento film. she accidentally takes a file with her stuff, which is basically the confessions of this deranged mind. And then she gets on a train and there's this beautiful like 12-minute really great sequence of cat and mouse done on a train, on a moving train. It's just really, I would watch it just for the opening 20 minutes, to be honest. There's some other good sequences, but you know, that is him close to old form. But the funny thing is they keep calling them the dwarf murders. And I'm not exactly sure throughout the movie why, because the killer is not a dwarf, but I kept thinking maybe it's a reference to, Don't Look Now or something weird. Mm-hmm. But they keep all the way through, they go, it's the dwarf murders. And I'm like, okay, but there's no dwarf in this movie, so I don't know why you're... It's really weird. It's like just treated as like some weird background info. But Van Suda is really good, and it's got some good sequences, and it's a little long. It's a full two-hour movie where you feel like at 90. It's a little bit like Deep Red, I guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would highly recommend people, when this Blu-ray does come out... I was watching it on DVD, but the quality was still totally fine. I think this one could actually work as resurgence, because I think people are always looking through his work hoping there's going to be something you missed or overlooked, that there's still some classics in there. And I would say this is
I don't think I've ever seen Sleepless.
Yeah, it had a really good cover, had a really scary face on it, which you never see in the movie, reaching like a hand, a skeletal hand reaching for you, but it has nothing to do with that. It's really, you know, about the boy who's now grown up and he's trying to solve the murders with Von Sydow, and that, you know, he has young people, and there's a little bit of the Guess Who It Is, but not too much. It's mostly just atmosphere, but I highly recommend it. Actually, it was a pleasant surprise from Dario. Nice. And the score, Goblin score, is pretty good too. It's not quite as up to their normal snuff, but
yeah, nice. I think somebody's supposed to be doing Sleepless and The Card Player.
Yeah, and Card Player is the other one. It's not as good movie, but it's shot really well. It's Gaspar Noé. The one thing I remember about Card Player was Gaspar Noé's cinematographer, Benoit Deby, who shot everything he's ever done, including Climax or anything, shoots this movie. So it's like seeing Argento work with a DP like that was like, it looked great and felt great. But again, it was the plots can really slow down his movies, unfortunately. But I would like to see Card Player again, too.
I like Card Player. That was one that I enjoyed. It wasn't perfect by any stretch, but I was into it. It was one of the first kind of internet murder movies I remember seeing, and I remember enjoying it.
Yeah, I'm curious. I can't really remember too much. I just remember the way it looked. I remember lots of cops and offices and white and stuff, but then beyond that, I'd have to see it again.
I liked it better than, like, Do You Like Hitchcock?
Yeah,
like,
no, that's trash. I mean, from when I saw that, it was bad. That was, like, a made-for-TV, I think.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I saw it on, like, DVD rental when I was living in New York. Yeah. But, yeah. But The Card Player, it had something that I at least was compelled to watch it the entire way through and stay really interested.
I guess the other one, getting the re-releases, the one him and Fulci did together, The Wax Mask.
Oh, yeah. Severin just put that out, or is about to.
It was about to, yeah. And I saw that when I was young, and I didn't like that, but I can't recall anything from it. So I will definitely
and
rewatch.
And Blue Underground is doing a really fancy version of Two Evil Eyes, which is Dario's movie with George Romero.
I actually like both those stories.
Really Two good. Evil Eyes, yeah.
Both stories are good.
Mm-hmm. The only one, I don't think I've ever seen Dario's Trauma from 1993.
Yeah.
I don't think I have either.
I'll be talking about that on a certain show soon, but I'm going to keep that under
my
hat. I'm going to keep that under my hat. It's really a bonkers movie. it's really one of his craziest.
Bonkers good or bonkers?
Both.
Okay.
Both terrible at times, like some of his worst stuff and some of his like mind-bendingly like most amazing moments.
Wow.
I can't remember if I just saw Blue of it recently. It must have been. It wasn't long ago, but yeah.
It's not available in America, but there's import versions of it. But I just always loved it because it was referenced in Lucky McKee's May.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I didn't even catch that.
Well, it's also famous for, I think like when we were young, it was famous for like, whoa, that chick's topless and look in your hair. Whoa, her dad made this. Whoa, this weird. Like I just remember having that conversation with so many people. Like, this is weird that the dad is directing her and she's standing in front of me or like combing her hair topless for no reason. And it's not even sexualized. That's the weird thing. It's like, it's even weirder because it's just treated natural. And you're like, that's just
she
weird.
Doesn't even too need normal? To be naked.
No, that's what
it's
I'm saying.
Weird
like,
thing.
Like in Stendhal, it's like, okay, this is all about sex and it's all about like rape and it's a really that's a really vicious ugly movie, but unless you're like, what is that anyway?
Yeah, no, that's how I felt in Dracula 3D where I was like, unnecessary nudity. No,
that
I
was
don't
completely
know
hot.
Why
with
that part with she's being scrubbed by people, that's hot.
But it's Asia scrubbing a naked woman that looks just like her but
yeah,
young.
Which is the weird
that's
thing.
The creepy
weird.
Part
yeah it's weird.
What's the name of her older sister who used to die in all the movies too? Like Asia's older sister.
No, I'm drawing a blank.
Wasn't a bunch of them too, and she would always die. So I find that – I think somebody could write such an interesting book about like Dario and Dutton, his wife with Daria.
Fiora.
It's just so interesting. And maybe it's just like we as Americans and Westerners like are much more, you know, judgy and close-minded of sexual. Like maybe it's just not as weird, this family stuff. But to me, it's pretty
being
weird.
Being around your naked kids.
It's
just
a little weird to me. But
Ozzy is pretty weird.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. That's been documented. So, but anyway. And it was, I think it was Dario's birthday not long ago, right? So –
Yeah.
Yeah. What a master. I think he's just written a huge book about his life, like an actual bio.
Oh, there's a bio of some sort. I don't know if you wrote it though.
No. The one that Derek, I can't remember his last name. Derek Botello did.
And there's Alan Jones's great book, which is just one of my favorite tomes, like on anyone. But no, I'm pretty sure Dario has just written a book called like Dario, like from his perspective. Yeah, the fear.
Fear, the autobiography of Argento.
I think he was signing it at the Fright Fest, and that's why
he was supposed to. Actually, he was supposed to be at Monster Blues this weekend, and he canceled.
Yeah. Well, he's
the autobiography, and it's by him.
Yeah, so I mean that's cool. Like I'd love to read. From
it's
his
it's actually on pre-order and comes out February 4th, 2020. Mm-hmm. So nice. It is coming.
Excellent.
Very that's cool.
Yeah. Speaking of books, just want to plug Elise Wax. Just wrote this beautiful, massive coffee table book on the entire legacy of It. It's amazing. Super just beautiful. All the behind the scenes stuff. It's got artist renderings. And
yeah, to contextualize, because I posted about it, and of course there's always one who's like, oh, you're congratulating your friend for writing a book about another book, or like some nonsense like that. It's like, okay, for the layman, there are movies that come out, and then there are hardcover books called The Art Of, and it's usually because there's a lot of artists that it takes a long time before you actually start shooting. Mm-hmm. I collect them. They're big for all the superhero movies.
Universal does them for
Universal,
a lot of their stuff.
Star Wars. I buy all of them because there are these beautiful coffee table books that pretty much shows you the entire production. It's interviews with everybody, kind of all the steps, storyboards, etc. So this is that for It, the new ones, not the original movie, not to do with the book. It's specifically for the two Andy Muschietti movies. But it is great. So all the pictures and everything, like Becca just described, is a really interesting insight into creating this version of that world, and everything in there, all the interviews and all the texts to contextualize it is all written by Elise. So there's always an author. They need an author to tell you what the hell you're looking at.
Yeah.
But no, this is a great companion piece if you love the movies. And even if you don't, that's the thing. It's like, I think I bought the one for like Batman v Superman, The Art Of, and like Brian Collins was making fun of me like, why would you buy that? I'm like, because I like Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman. Yeah. The movie doesn't matter. I like all the designs and the costumes and the settings and all that. Like, it's just cool.
They do them for a lot of Disney movies too. So I've picked them up for Disney, and it's just fascinating to see kind of how the films are put together. Like you see them for Pixar stuff as well. So yeah, they're fun, but definitely check out the It one. It's at Barnes and Noble, and you can find it on Amazon as well. I think it's like maybe $25.
Yeah, it's $25. It's called The World of It.
Yeah. For a big, like heavy, heavy coffee table book. It's a really good price.
I'm still waiting for Rob G to weigh in on It too.
I'm still waiting. It.
It's only 3 hours.
What? Yeah. Only three hours. Only 3 hours.
It'll be as long as this podcast. Yeah. Right now.
Well, I watched one other thing, and I actually watched it last week, but didn't get a chance to talk about it. But I want to, because it was one that I revisited and it completely changed my mind on it. And this is 2008 Sauna. Do you guys remember this one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Finland,
so
they're saying?
It's from Finnish. It's Finnish. It is directed by Antti Jussi-Anila. And I had originally seen this at, I want to say, Toronto Film Festival. And it was like a 10 o'clock showing. And I honestly was struggling to stay awake because it's very slow burn. It doesn't have a lot
of historical at the start.
It's very historical. Well, it's historical the whole way through. And it's a very slow burn. And it's not in English. So there was a lot of reading involved. And I was struggling to stay awake through it. And I was really appreciative coming out of that in 2008 when I first saw it. I was really appreciative of the setting, and it's got this one really creepy set piece at the end, but I was kind of like, oh, it was a little bit of a slog. Rewatched it a couple of days ago because I was just, it was on one of the VOD channels, and I was like, cool, I'll just put this on while I'm working. and revisit it, and absolutely fell in love with it on the second time 10 years later. The setup is that it is the late 1500s, and there has just been this absolutely brutal war between Sweden and Russia. And these two Finnish brother cartographers are being forced. They've just been defeated, and they now have a pack of kind of war-loving Russians who are forcing them to redraw the maps of the countries. And so they're trudging through this absolutely horrible cold swampland in the 1500s with this pack of Russians who have just defeated their country while they're being forced to redraw everything. And so it just begins with this super oppressive environment, and everything's really bleak and gray. And they happen upon this one tiny town where there are no children. And they end up kind of getting trapped there for a few days. And this one town has this sauna, which is not what we think of as a sauna. It's not like a nice little hot place with, you know, coals and you can go and look younger or anything like that. It's literally a big stone building in the middle of a lake, pitch black inside. And the lake, I struggle to call it a lake. It's kind of like a swamp with a big stone building in the middle of it. And but immediately kind of the town starts to affect everybody, and they all start kind of getting a little bit more psychotic over time, escalating to the end, and where it just kind of goes off the rails at the end. But yeah, it was a really nice little slow burn psychological thriller on this watch, and I really enjoyed it far more than I did the first time. So I recommend it.
I can't recall, like, I remember it pretty well, the buildup. I have no idea where the horror part comes in. Like, my brain's going, oh yeah, what happens to make it a horror film? I don't recall where the death stuff happens.
And I think that was also part of the problem with seeing it at like a midnight screening, because there's no monster that, you know, takes over the second act. It's not like everybody turns into a vampire or anything like that. It's very psychological, and everybody just slowly becoming unhinged. Mm-hmm. And then all of these things that they've done in their past get revealed, and you discover that this is all somehow connected to the sauna in the middle of the lake. But it's all really slow. If this came out now, I think people would take it a little bit more, because it's paced very much like The Witch, or some of our other what they call elevated horrors, where it's paced very much the same, where nothing happens and then something slightly happens, but it sets the whole tone. And then in another 20 minutes, another slightly creepy thing will happen. So it's matching pacing with more of what's coming out now than in 2008. Hmm. But yeah, it's definitely worth revisiting.
Yeah, I saw it last year. I just can't even remember. It's like it's amnesia. It's setting in, man. We're getting old. 160 episodes. How do we do it?
On top of the 140 we did before.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, that means this is episode 300.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, if you go back. Shit.
Turn it podcast.
If you go back to Killer POV, there is probably a review of me seeing it the first time going, I don't know, it was a little slow. I kind of was drifting in and out of consciousness. But yeah, 10 years later, I enjoyed it.
Then we should celebrate our 300th episode with friends of the show. Instead of like getting some big guests, I say we get like people we know. And we just like
it's
have a
almost like we planned it this way,
right?
Almost, because we actually didn't, and it just happens to be the case.
Wow,
so that's kind of nice.
It is. And you know, before we break, I forgot to mention it last week, and I just want to give a shout out to Cedric from France, because when I was on my trip seeing Alyssa in Paris, France, there was a rooftop screening of Wayne's World that I went to in French. I figured I'd seen it enough that I'll know what they're saying. And Alyssa and I ended up meeting with Cedric, who's a listener from over there. Mm-hmm. And never met him in person, obviously, until this, but we sat down and we had a couple of beers, and it was really beautiful. He was telling me that, you know, hey, he's married, he has kids, he lives just outside of Paris, outside of the city, and he doesn't really have friends to talk to about horror movies. And so he listens to us every week. And feels like he's talking horror with friends. So, and he loves Pure Cinema. So I was like, if Elric was here, this conversation would go all out.
We're talking about a classy man.
Yeah. So no, it's just a reminder that, it's pretty crazy that we can even reach that far. And that's, you know,
well, and that's
talk
one of the,
horror.
That's definitely the reason after 300 episodes, one of the reasons to keep going is obviously you connect to people, and that makes you keep doing it. I think for us, speaking of which, we will quick plug before we go into it. Just we have a couple places where we're going to physically be.
Yeah.
A couple of us are definitely, Shockwaves will definitely be at Salem Horror Film Festival, and we will definitely
All three will be at Knoxville.
Well, all three minus Ryan, who's not part of three. But if all four were there, but Ryan's obviously very busy with Halloween, so that's awesome. We will all be in Knoxville, and it's going to be pretty bonk. I think that's going to be a bonk
show. Knoxville Film Festival.
Because we're there for multiple days. It's a small town. It's a small theater, Central Cinema, and we have a Girdlerfest as part, Girdlerthon as part of it. There's a lot of great film premieres happening, so we haven't even discussed what the show we're going to do yet, so that's going to be
fun. Yeah, we haven't even picked a topic, guys.
We'll do something crazy, I think, but it'll be a good time. So if you're at either of those, message us so we know you're there and, you know, come say hi.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Also, the Crypt Keeper is going to be in Salem.
So. Yeah, in Salem, yeah. So you're going to hear from our sponsors again, and then we're actually going to play a piece of music for you. Keller Special, which ties into the Halloween season and one of our three guests today. So we'll be right back.
Enjoy.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Newly released collections feature brand new shirts for Rob Zombie's Three from Hell, as well as the new Halloween classic, Josh Hastie's Candy Corn. Stay tuned next Wednesday, September 25th, for our 10th anniversary Saw collection, featuring a new shirt, socks, and wax pack trading cards with autographs by Tobin Bell and Shawnee Smith randomly inserted. All officially licensed and available exclusively at fright-rags.com. Listeners get 10% off their first order with the code WAVES10. Again, that is 10% off by using WAVES10 at fright-rags.com.
It's Halloween. Where is everyone?
We should be partying and having fun.
Not this year. No Monster Mash.
But everyone loves it.
It was a graveyard smash.
Halloween night is the one night a year the three of us can go out without any fear.
Where will we go?
Out in the streets.
Yes, this is the year we monsters trick or treat.
Trick or treat.
I didn't bring a costume.
Monsters trick or treat.
Think people will notice my hunchback?
Give us something sweet.
Perhaps a hat and a mask. I could be Zorro.
Monsters trick or treat.
Trick or treat.
We're still too scared. We should go home.
I hear the wolfman's in the graveyard digging up bones.
Nonsense. We just need to try another door.
Like this one?
I bet they have candy galore.
Trick or treat.
You don't know what it's like to carry candy with a hunchback.
Monsters trick or treat.
None of these candies have any blood.
Give us something sweet.
Delicious treats made of sugar.
A monster's trick or treat.
Trick or treat.
Oh! Hey, look, there's the creature, the mummy, and the hag.
They've all got candy stuffed in their bags.
How did you do it? What was your trick?
I cast a spell upon them, made them think we were kids.
Trick or treat.
I do not do any spells on children anymore.
Monster's trick or treat.
That was a lot of fun.
Give us something sweet.
I would like to do this next year, yes.
A monster's trick or treat.
Next year.
Trick or treat.
Trick or treat.
You know the sun is starting to rise.
A monster's trick or treat.
I should be going to the coffin.
Give us something sweet.
You throw one girl into a river
a
and everybody
trick
gets
or treat.
Mad. I'm sorry.
Trick or treat.
All right, and welcome back. And instead of the Shockwaves theme there after the ads, what you heard was a little ditty called The Monster's Trick or Treat by John Frankie Steins. Oh, I get it.
Get it? actually, that is the gentleman doing the voices is named John Steins. So like Bobby Boris Pickett. That's John Frankie.
Wow, I love that.
Steins.
So
nice.
And we're celebrating that, which is the release of The Killer Sounds of Halloween, an album by Sean Keller, one of our guests tonight. Welcome.
So fun.
Great album.
Thank you.
Yeah. We also have a filmmaker friend of ours, Matthew Curry Holmes.
Hi.
Hello. Hey, welcome. Matthew Curry Holmes.
Hey, guys.
We'll be talking about your new movie, The Curse of Buckout Road.
Yes, sir.
Coming out later this month. And last but not least, my brother from another mother returning, one of my two dudes.
Yeah.
Tony Giles is here. How are you, man?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm just a token. I have nothing to promote or talk about. I'm just here for the free.
But you're in this.
Water.
You're here.
You're here.
So you had to join
here.
Us again.
Yes. Yes.
Is there a reason that you have traveled to Los Angeles?
Well,
is it-
we can talk about that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we can.
You're the ringer
right now.
You're the ringer.
Right now, we're going to start with you because you just came from MondoCon.
I did. I was at MondoCon this past weekend.
What is MondoCon for the uninitiated?
Okay, so for any of the soundtrack enthusiasts out there, they will be aware of the record label Mondo and also the mass-producing poster company Mondo, who is owned by the Alamo Drafthouse. And essentially, MondoCon is basically a convention run by Mondo.
Mm-hmm. See what That's they did insane there? That they have gotten this big.
I know. It's in Austin, Texas, where the sun officially hates humans. It was 100 degrees every day. I was there for 4 days.
Englishmen.
I was only outside. What did I do? I was outside for maybe 25 minutes, and it was just I'm not going to use the term ball soup, but it was very
good. I think you just did.
I think you can. That is not a common term around here. Yeah. Feel free to drop ball soup.
Yeah, so there was some of that going on, but it was cool. You know, there was a little area for vinyl. I was there with one of my labels, Tiger Lab Vinyl, and there were a few other guys, Terrorvision Records, Burning Witches Records, Mondo themselves, Kadabra Records, Enjoy the Ride Records, and Terrorvision, who all do horror-related stuff, but it was mainly artists and posters, tons and tons of posters. Drew Struzan was there. That was pretty cool. Yeah, he was pretty cool. I met the Fangoria dudes there. Mm-hmm. Yes. Brandon was there and two other guys. And I'm really sorry that I can't remember your name.
James Wallace.
He was Jason. One. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Probably other guy.
Yeah, so I didn't even need,
if I work
didn't need to remember them. Yeah. So, I mean, it was fun. I did a panel on soundtracks, which was pretty cool. Talking about the, you know, where soundtracks are going and what we're doing. So that was cool. That was fun. I came into town for MondoCon and then my other label I work for is Lakeshore Records, and we are releasing the soundtrack for Red Dead Redemption 2 on Friday. So by the time you hear this, it will be out. And previous to this, the day before you hear this and you won't be able to get them, there's a signing at Amoeba Records with Daniel Lemoir. So,
he did one of my favorite tracks on Until the End of the World soundtrack.
Yes.
I've listened to that soundtrack like 100 times and never seen the film. Because I've been waiting for the long version. Yeah. I just heard yesterday. So it's going to be
speaking of Canadians, it's pretty cool. Lemoir, So yeah, tomorrow I get to meet and cower in the
great presence.
Exactly. So I'm going to go and do that. And it's actually his birthday. I just found out.
Happy birthday, Daniel! Happy birthday, man! So I'm sure he's listening by now.
A button to that is the guy who composed the music for my movie, Ryan Shore, Howard Shore's nephew, was basically Daniel Lanois was like his uncle. And they would always hang out at his. He would tell me stories about like. He lived in this giant loft in Toronto and Montreal. I guess he had two. And he's Daniel Lanois. I guess he probably had four. But it was like a giant space because each sort of section would have a different acoustic resonation to it. And it was just like covered in all these fantastic instruments and stuff.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's very cool. And then, you know, a couple of weeks down the road, we have Stranger Things 3.
Oh, the score.
The score for Stranger Things 3. Yeah, the soundtrack, I don't know.
What?
but the score, yeah. So that's coming out. So yeah, it's a good time to be in California. We have lots of stuff going on, and it's not as hot as Austin. So thumbs up all around.
Wow,
excellent. And so let's shift back to Sean because we played a track. How the hell did this happen? I mean, I know you love Halloween, and anybody that's ever – I don't know if you haven't been on Shockwaves, but one of our most fun episodes was back on
–
Killer POV. Yep.
I remember the photo where we're all sitting at your feet and you're teaching us.
Kids and children and when to show children horror. And,
yes,
that
was it.
We had a nice little convo about me wrecking my children apparently.
Yes.
But except since then, one of your kids has done the title track on Satanic Panic.
That's correct. True.
It just came out. Yep. And also we should mention that you wrote one of the best of the Hulu series All That We Destroy this year. So that's also
I co-wrote with my writing partner, James Agnew. Yes.
Credit where credit is due.
But it's great. That's a great episode. Like I've told you a bunch of times.
Thank you.
I love that episode.
Yeah. As I was listening to your other podcast about soundtracks, I was like, when are you going to talk about this needle drop in my movie?
Which one?
In All That We Destroy. The baby's track that plays over and everyone's come on, give me a shout out, Eric.
We were doing the whole soundtrack. So.
So obviously you're prolific in other aspects, primarily known for writing and all that. But you love Halloween, I know. Since I first moved to town, it's been a big – basically we're starting now. Everybody in this room starts mid-September. We start celebrating. So how did this crazy idea of doing an album – which is not really a Sean Keller album, technically, but it's various artists all doing these Halloween-y songs.
Well, I I have so many influences on this, but I always love making a Halloween mixtape every year for everyone, or a mix CD or a playlist. Usually make burn it to disc and hand it to people. And I love just sort of balancing the classic novelty stuff with newer songs and little niche things. And so I've been doing them every year. And in addition to that, I've been doing usually a Halloween cover song every year where I'll cover a horror-y themed song in the style of a completely different band. Like I did TV on the Radio's Wolf Like Me, but I did it in the style of Love and Rockets. And I did Dolly Parton's Dolly Parton's Drinkenstein in the style of Rob Zombie. And I did Pet Sematary in like a very haunted country way. And so I was never very good as a musician at sticking to one thing. I never really found my voice. I was a songwriter first, and I've been an actor and all these other things. But as a songwriter, I never really had like that one thing I did. I wanted to do it all. And when I wrote an original song last Halloween called Don't Forget My Ghost, which is the final song on this album, it was an original haunted country thing. And I'm like, I'll do a whole album of that. And then, of course, I get really bored writing a whole bunch of songs in the same genre. So I'm like, all right, fuck that. I'm going to make a mixtape, and I'm going to make up 13 fake bands, and I'm going to write in 13 different styles, and I'm going to put little interstitials in between. And I'm like, a lovely idea to have in May when, you know, I can sort of blow it away as a little pipe dream. But then as the months start ticking away, I'm like, oh shit, I kind of have to do this, don't I? And so I just one by one started writing songs and banging them out with my son in his bedroom. My son Folsom is a marvelous recording engineer and a heck of a musician. And he's becoming a pretty good singer too. But I just work him to death because
you birthed him.
Because he's there and I can't.
18 years, man. Great.
I know he's going to be moving out soon. And there's this like move to, hey, when's Folsom going to move out? And I'm like, I'm not done with my album yet. Not yet. So he and I have been working since, I guess, I did Don't Forget My Ghost last Halloween and didn't really start up again until I wrote It Came From Outer Space, the sort of psychobilly rave up that's on the somewhere in the middle of the album in the beginning of July. And from then on, it's been a full court press. It's been nonstop just songwriting and coming up with different styles. And then the fun thing of naming the bands and bringing in guest vocalists so it doesn't all sound like me. Because my girlfriend Chelsea, Chelsea Stardust, awesome director, is the voice in my head that when I start going off the deep end, she's like, maybe you need separate voices on this. Maybe this shouldn't just be the Sean Keller show and be this like self-serving ego jerk. And she was duh, right. And bringing in other vocalists all of a sudden changed the timbre of it. It took control out of my hands a little bit, which was kind of great.
Yeah, well, also you get to work with all these friends and people that we've had on the show, like Graham Skipper and Jesse Merlin and all these people.
And directing them in singing is fun because all of them have different skills. They all respond in different ways. It's very much like getting an acting performance out of someone. And so I usually don't get to play director. I'm the writer, and I don't get as much say in that realm. And it was really fun to deal with these really talented singers and figuring out where their skills were and what I needed them to bring to it to make it satisfy me, but also let them satisfy themselves. And, you know, it's just a joy. We had Natasha Carmody came out and played violin.
I love that.
On the Terror at Blood Lake, which is from the same world as Slashed. That's my favorite song. It's as if there was the event in Slashed was like a real thing that inspired two different artists to do two different things. And Slashed the musical is one interpretation. And then this song is a completely like Bobby Gentry style country ballad. But I brought Natasha in and she's like, well, what do you want? And she wanted things all charted out and I don't know how to read or write music. And so I'm like, play. And so she played a bunch of things. And I was just like, a little more of this, a little more of that. And then I think she was a little impressed because she got it back and I took a whole bunch of her tracks and sort of started stacking them because she was playing things that weren't intended to be layered and played as harmonies. But I'd like stacked them around and moved them around and turned it into this sort of great little thing. I mean, she's awesome, but I also don't like to waste anyone's time. So when I bring someone into the studio to record with me, I'm like, you're in for like an hour and we're done. We're going to go. Like you're going to Graham Skipper comes in and sing the song. Like you're going to sing the song like 10 times and that's it. And you're out. You know, I had Jesse Merlin come in to do the intro
That voice.
We were talking on the break that he needs his own show.
He should be a horror host. That's what I'm saying. He should be an LA horror host.
And that was pretty much the guy. And I had to, like, I had to ask Jesse Merlin to go further, which was really
there's
fun.
No way.
Because you know, he just drips with enthusiasm for things. And so it was fun to, like, I'm like, no, dude, just lean into it. This is like cheesy horror host territory. It's, you know, and that's not, that intro is just straight up, you know, chilling, thrilling sounds of the haunted house stuff, like Disney novelty records.
I still have those records.
I still do. I listen to them all the time. That's the biggest inspiration for this.
I only listen to them now. I was telling Tony on the way here. I was like, this is great, but I only listen to it in October. I can't in March be like, I'm going to listen to the haunted sounds of Halloween or whatever. But there's fun stuff. So WNUF did a little commercial for
the,
you.
Right? The folks, Chris LaMartina. I asked him very politely. I'm like, hey, would you contribute something? And so he put together a Dr. Blood Wrench ad for a double feature of two Dr. Blood Wrench movies. One is the Tale of the Headless Surfer, and the other one is about invisible anacondas called Boo Hiss. Ghost anacondas. Invisible ghost anacondas. Just delicious.
I kind of want that movie, Sean. Work on that.
I kind of want to see that happen, too.
And we can make it a musical. I'm there.
Sure. Okay. And so he and I sort of traded services. I did a couple of voices for WNUF 2 coming up soon. So.
Oh, wow. Excellent. And, Amanda Weiss from Nightmare on Elm Street singing a song Amanda Wiss. I'm sorry. I always do that every
time. Amanda Wiss.
I always apologize to her for it. Amanda Wiss singing I'm Gonna Have a Nightmare.
Well, she's not even singing it. This is a poem.
A poem?
As she reads a creepy kids poem. And that one is scored by Curtis RX from Creature Features. Oh. And so it's the two of them together in a very weird way. But it's a creepy little poem about a young girl, you know, who's gonna have nightmares and she knows it's coming. And
She's not afraid of that. She's kind of excited about having it. It's a really strong album.
She's marvelous and was so excited to do it because she's like, I've never done an album. I'm like, well, let's go. I love putting her in weird things.
Yeah.
I cast her in a movie a little bit 3 years ago in the role that was supposed to be mine. And I was like, you know what? I want you to play it. She's like, this is a guy. I'm like, not anymore.
That's so fun. So this is out now, right?
This is out now. It is on Bandcamp. That is the Killer Sounds of Halloween. Go get it, man. It's for $6.66. And if you can't handle the infernal price, you can always pay more.
I did proudly.
Yeah, so $6.67 for you.
No, I paid $10.
Could it ever be a physical release?
I really want to do a vinyl release of it next year. I just didn't have enough time this year.
It takes a while.
I didn't finish mixing master. Actually, I recorded the very last track Sunday.
Right.
And mixed and finished mixing and mastering Sunday night and made it live Monday morning. So, I just came down to the wire and there was absolutely no time to get a vinyl release, but that is the goal. So, this way I can sort of gauge how it does as a digital release, and it's already moving kind of well, which is great. But if it's, looks good, I had an offer from Lakeshore actually to put it out.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. But not as a vinyl, just as a digital release.
Really?
I can talk about it afterward. But I just wanted to control this one this time and just put it out simply through Bandcamp and make it a real easy thing for me to put up and take care of.
Yeah. Cool. And there's always next year. Yeah. If you want to go physical.
There's always next year.
So. And a part two.
My favorite thing was watching your Twitter feed during the course of the recording. Just, hey guys, any ideas? Give me two words that mean totally different things that have to do with Halloween in the style of Peter Murphy from Bauhaus. And then just looking at the responses, and I'm like, did that end up making it?
Some stuff did.
Like bon two Jersey. Words that rhyme with purple.
Michael Verratti, I put out a call because I'm like, I need to make a fake movie trailer. The one thing I think is that I did with this, I didn't make fun of anything. Every single song in here is done with love. This isn't like Weird Al where I'm smarter than you and I'm gonna poke at it. Like everything in here is this sort of heartfelt love for all these things. And so I did a slasher movie trailer, a fake slasher movie trailer, and I was looking for just movie names. And Michael Verratti sent me like 30 right away. And one of them was Axe Night. And I was like, oh, well,
that's a good name.
So I did Axe Night 4, The Lumberjack's Back. little Billy Cleaver, who's the boy whose hand was replaced with an axe, is back. And making these, it was just, this like joyous exploration of all the things I love about Halloween, all the little niche things I love about songs in movies. Cause like one of these songs is a theme song from a movie that doesn't exist. You know, I've got it's called Never Get Out Alive, the theme from Devil's Drive-In, which I put up on, and if you look on the Bandcamp like information, it says from the lost 1991 movie starring Billy Zane and Shannon Doherty. and so like the idea was, hey, what if Kenny Loggins wrote the theme to a medium budget horror flick and then sort of passed it off for Bon Jovi to sing. And that was like, all right, this is the, like everything had to have a hat on a hat, like weird reference on top of weird reference.
That's Bon Jersey.
And that's Jersey. The band Bon Jersey. Because everything has a fake band name.
I got to say, I was a little disappointed when I got to Bon Jersey because it did sound like Kenny Loggins and not Bon Jovi. I was like, it's Kenny Loggins.
I mean, the band names are fun though. Come on.
It's perfect.
I got one of them is Donnie Elbert and the Flames. No, Donald Elbert is the trash can man. And so my song about pyromania from The Stand, Stephen King, you know.
Wow.
It's yeah.
That's
it's
deep.
I'm obsessed. It's a bad thing.
Well, you played it for me today in the car. Yeah. Yeah, we listened to this and Ghost.
Yeah, there's a new Ghost single out as well. So, yeah.
Okay.
No, but it's a lot of fun. I think we've already been encouraging people to check it out, but I mean, this is perfect to get into the Halloween season with. So check it out. We're going to play another track at the end of the show. But we also have Matthew Curry Holmes on Shockwaves. This could be your first appearance on a show.
Oh, my God. How is it? Yeah, weird. Weren't you on Killer POV?
No, I was mentioned.
He was on Inside Horror.
Oh, that's
Inside
Horror.
Okay. Panel episode. And we met this week in Horror. The show I did even before that, the show I met you.
Mm-hmm. So this with Brian Trenchard-Smith.
Yeah, Brian Trenchard-Smith was coming on, who, you know, everyone hears Tarantino, what, called him his favorite director or something. Yeah. Suddenly had a rebirth. The Australian director. No, this is a long time.
He's got a lot of favorites.
In exploitation. But so we had Brian Trenchard-Smith on the show, and Matt knew Stacy, I believe, and wrote to us saying, oh, could I just show up because I'd been in a movie from Brian once, you know, years before.
The first film I ever acted in was his movie, and I had a lead role in it. Like, I shouldn't say the first movie that I acted in, but my first lead role he cast me in, a movie called Sightings, Heartland Ghost. So when he went on the show, I wanted to.
Right, and on that show, I basically wrote all the questions for everyone, but didn't actually go on. I basically did what I did here, but wrote it all and fed it to them through like a microphone.
Yeah.
and so I'm sitting in the back, like basically doing that, sitting with Matt, and you're watching the screen. We just hit it off, and I think we had dinner afterwards.
Yeah.
Not with Brian. Yeah, just with us.
No.
And Stacey probably, but not Trencher.
Yeah, no, Trencher.
Anyway, and we've known each other ever since. And,
I've known Matt. I actually knew him before I moved to L.A., because I met you at San Diego Comic-Con still living in New York City.
Yeah, he was in your short. That's one of the first things
That's because
we met at Comic-Con, I was working with an artist friend of mine, Tara McPherson.
Yep.
I was at her booth helping her out because my wife, Shannon, had a pop-up gallery with Tara McPherson and Alex Party, and they were doing this you know, this great pop art that they were doing. And Tara asked, she's like, hey, do you want to come to Comic-Con? And, you know, would you mind helping out at the booth? And we're like, yeah, sure, no problem.
And this concludes Matthew Curran. This is your life.
That's how I met Rebecca, because I was Fangoria, and I'm just like, I love horror movies, Fangoria. And
that was like a year before I moved out to LA, but that's why he's in my short, is literally I shot that like 2 months after I moved
here. Because you mentioned Wrong Turn
2. And I didn't know anybody.
You mentioned Wrong Turn 2, you're like, because Amanda Fuller was
there. At the booth hanging out with
me. And I did a movie with Amanda Fuller like years ago in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
And we've already gone off because we didn't mention that this is the 14th anniversary, and this is important, and you know where I'm going. This is the 14th anniversary of the Fog remake. To which Matthew's
version of the Fog, I stand by it. And the only reason why I stand by it, the only reason why I stand by it is because it's the only one of the two versions that pays me money. I make residuals.
Anytime that's on, I only keep watching because I got to watch Matt's scene. Then I see him, I'm like, off.
Well, Ryan Turk.
I love seeing you on it, though.
No, Ryan, it was funny. I don't know if you were there when Ryan just discovered I was on the Fog.
I don't know if
we were at Jump Cut.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he just looked at me and he's like, wait. wait, what?
I believe
you were,
that. I mean,
you were in the remake of The Fog? Yeah. Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, I'm like, daddy.
But Wrong Turn 2, you are really fun in Wrong Turn 2 as the director. And Joe Lynch is, and that's the one of the best of them because it's the most off the rails.
It's my favorite.
Yeah, it's fun.
I'm not going to lie, it's my favorite too.
And you're wearing a Battle Royale t-shirt in Wrong Turn 2, which seems like a total Joe idea, or is it you?
No,
or
so.
Both? Are you playing Joe Lynch?
Wait, did you wear that to the audition?
Yeah, okay.
Joe Lynch told me
the most roundabout interview I think we've ever done.
We'll get to the movie that I directed eventually, but here's a fun story about my buddy Joe
Lynch.
Can
we go back to L Word? No, that's how I discovered you as L Word. I'm not even kidding. I saw you on L
Word. Why don't we just do Queers Folk? I mean, we'll just do them all. Let's just go through my whole, you know, the.
I got the IMDb open.
Yeah, great. There it is. Like, oh, there's no hiding. There's 40 of them. That's fine. And they're not all great.
Firewall.
No, with Firewall.
Harrison Ford.
Harrison Ford. And thank you very much, guys. Bye. So, to answer your question, Rob, it was in the script when it was my first audition back after my daughter was born. I'd taken 6 months off to sort of be with my – or sorry, 3 months off to be with my daughter. And my agent's like, hey, there's Wrong Turn 2. Do you want to audition for it? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And I read the script. And I was reading the sides, and there were things like that didn't seem like a straight to video horror sequel, like kind of written just automatically, you know, like, oh, this is just really simple. We're just going to kind of churn this out. One was like, she was described as suicide girl sexy. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then he wore a Battle Royale shirt. Yeah. And I was like, oh. So I went into, and I had a Battle Royale shirt, and I was like, I got to know who this guy is. And so I walked into the audition, and Joe Lynch, it was his first film, and he was like caffeinated.
Oh, yes.
He comes out. He's like,
I think that's just Joe Lynch.
And he calmed down a little.
Yeah. But I mean, he came in, and I was in the room, and, you know, we're actors, and we're preparing. It was Michael Eklund and I. And we're preparing, and he looks at me, and he sees my Battle Royale shirt, and he's like, oh, my God, come here. And I walk inside, and he goes, okay, roll the camera. Tell me everything you know about Battle Royale. I'm like, okay, it was amazing. It was the thing with the violence and the thing, and it was allegorical of all the, you know, Lord of the Flies, blah, 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 and just kind of went on this whole diatribe of Battle Royale and how amazing and violent and stupendous it was. And then at the end of it, I was just like, okay, thanks. I guess we're done. And then Joe just like, that was great. Did you get it? Okay, great. That was awesome. And I looked at Joe. And I was like, you're way more interesting than the choice that I made coming in here. And I said, can you give me 5 minutes? Like, just give me. He's like, yeah, no problem. And I was just kind of taking him in. And then when I did my audition, I did Joe Lynch in the audition because I was like, he was so connected and so fucking happy and just so energetic and just passionate about everything. And the part was written kind of cool guy, asshole. And so I'm not embarrassed to say that I, you know, prepared cool guy asshole. But just before I did it, I just said, give me 5 minutes. I really want to try something here. And then I played Joe Lynch and I got the part. So that was
it. And you got to – and weird connection here because I just – you are both Sean and Matt are in my documentary that I just made, which I showed to Tony today. And also in that doc is Henry Rollins, who you worked with on Wrong Turn 2.
Who made me 2 mix CDs.
See? Didn't you make him a mix too?
I did. I made him a mix. I made him a mix. Sadly, I don't think I even came close to how amazing his mix was because I got some like unreleased Buzzcocks. I got some Minor Threat B-sides. I was like, holy shit.
I guarantee you your mix is somewhere in that media room.
It must be.
He never gets rid of anything. So it is still there.
Well, I'm a big shoegaze darkwave fan. So I was like, we started talking about music and I'm way more into, you know, old 80s goth and darkwave. And I love the new resurgence of darkwave now. But at the time there was, I think, a band called I Love You But I've Chosen Darkness. And there was a couple bands and I was like, have you heard of these guys? He's like, no. I go, I think they actually might be kind of the real deal. And can I make you a mix? He's like, sure. And then next day he comes in with 2 CDs and I'm like, of course.
I love that.
Thank you, Henry Rollins.
That is pretty cool.
You're amazing.
You offered a mix and he went home and thought about it and he's like, all right, I need to make 2 CDs. This is the music I need to share with
And he never made any excuses and none of it felt – it was all curated. Like none of it felt like it was just kind of thrown together. And I mean, we didn't know each other well. We had some fun times on set, but – you know, and he's a huge coffee fan, so I gave him some Canadian coffee, Kicking Horse coffee, and he's like, oh, when you come to LA, you got to try Pete's, because that was at the time just an LA thing, and so I was...
That's pretty cool. And to round it off, I've got a Black Flag tattoo.
Yeah! Oh!
things. So much synchronicity. I love it.
And, oh, wait, there's more.
Uh-oh.
I first saw Rollins Band's play at the 9:30 Club, and Sean Keller is wearing the shirt now.
I was probably at that show. So.
I think you probably were.
And I saw my copy of Pissing in the Gene Pool by Henry Rollins. It is one of my favorite books of his.
Yes.
This is very strange.
Yeah, this is weird.
Actually, why haven't we never had Henry on? Henry's never been here.
I don't know.
That's got to happen. Maybe close to your
I'll try.
The good news is we're all ordering Chinese, and we're just going to basically reminisce about all of that. Now, Rob, how did we meet? That's what I want to know.
I actually don't know.
I bet it'll be at Jump Cut.
Probably.
Really?
I bet the timeline for that would be then. Yeah. Like that.
Because I know you already knew everybody when I met you, I believe. Yeah.
I knew, the great thing about our show is that I knew you the least. Me and you knew, like, I had worked with Becca, I had met Sean, I'd met you, but I feel like me and you, we really didn't know each other.
Well, that was the fun of Killer POV.
Yeah.
Is that we had one meeting, because basically at Geek Nation, they wanted to do a horror show, and Andrew Cash was doing some stuff for them and said, it should be Rob G., Elric, and Rebecca. And so we met once, and we got along in the room, and then
It was literally like 24 hours later we were doing a show together.
Yeah, episode one was our second meeting, and I kept telling you, I was like, no, I don't want to know you. Let's talk on the show.
Let's figure this out.
We'll get to know each other.
Every time I text you to hang out, that's what you say to me.
I still don't want to know you.
Can
you save this phone call for the show? Oh, so
it's 300 episodes in. I don't want to know you, Elric.
It's too late, Rob.
So Andrew Cash
edited
the first trailer for The Curse of Buckeye Run.
There you go.
And thus, we eventually
Holy shit.
And that's all we have time for.
And then we'll see you later. September 27th.
I'm out. But let's talk about your new movie, because this is the first thing you directed, first feature you've directed.
It's the first feature that I directed that's coming out.
Yes.
I did direct a feature before this.
Which my daughter's in.
Yes.
And I've seen a rough cut of.
I did, yes. And I actually have news about that.
Excited baseball.
Yeah, I actually have news about that. That movie will be coming out in 2020.
Good.
Picked up by the same company that did Buckout Road. They picked it up for distribution. So it's called Traces, but that's not horror. So.
And Rick Springfield's in it.
And Rick Springfield is in it.
But it is musical related. So.
It is musical related. So
this is a music episode.
I can't speak to it too much because the deal's kind of not done. So this is, I'm breaking news right now. God, I hope it doesn't fuck up, and that I've just maybe we'll just edit this out. Buckout Road was my first feature that came out. Actually, while I was editing Traces, I got a call from Paul Weber, who's a casting director, a friend of mine that we'd worked with previous, and a producer. And he called me up and said, "There's these producers up in Canada. They have a script." They actually have two scripts that they're kind of vacillating back and forth. We have a start date, but the script's not where it needs to be. Would you come in and do a polish? And I said, yeah. You're going to pay me to write? Absolutely. So Paul Weber hooked me up with the producers, and I read the scripts, and we could have gone one of two ways. We could have kind of Franken-scripted the thing together and said, okay, here you go. But I had a thought that I had an idea that I really wanted to explore. So I pitched them a page one rewrite. And of course they're panicking because it was, I think at the time, April. Yeah, it was March. And they were starting in, at the time, July. And they're like, okay, what's your pitch? And I said, guys, let me write you I'll give you like a 20-page treatment for free. And if you like it, I'll get started right away. And so they read it and they're like, oh my God, this is so much better than what we have. And I was able to kind of take a little bit from column A and column B. And the result was sort of Buckout Road. At the time, it was called Buckout Road. It's now called The Curse of Buckout Road. And sort of midway through the process, they said it was like a first draft that came out. And they read it and they said, that's great. Listen, our director, listen, do you want to direct this? You're Canadian. We think it would be really great. You just directed a film. And like a fucking idiot, because it was a first draft. I'm like, oh, I can't direct this. It's a first draft. No, we're not ready. Not thinking, give myself the benefit of the doubt that perhaps maybe I'll give myself a couple of passes to get it worthy.
And then wife, you are really critical of your
my
own
wife,
work.
Well, because it's the first draft. Who directs the first draft? Okay. Yeah. No one. If you're a professional, Sean, back me up.
Well, I saw 31.
Oh, Sean. Okay.
Zing.
So
we just lost Sherry as a listener.
Okay. So my wife just kind of like in the background goes, are you out of your fucking mind? Of course you're going to fix it. Like, that's what you do. So I called him back. I'm like, yes, I would love to. So I went through the process, getting the notes and everything. And then we pushed from July to August, and then come August, we shot the movie, and we had Danny Glover was already attached.
Man who kills Predator.
Exactly. That's amazing. In his great return to horror, and Evan Ross, son of renowned singer Diana. I don't know if you've heard of
him. Wasn't Calm Fiore in it?
Calm Fiore's in it.
I love Calm Fiore.
Canadian royalty. Embarrassment of Rich, like getting the cast. My producer would come up to me and he's like, "So, what do you think of Calm? Do you think he could be in this movie?" I'm like, "Yes, absolutely." Yeah. And he's like, "What about Henry Cherney? Is it okay for he's asking my permission?" I'm like, "We fucking great, yes, yes, reciprocity, yes, put him in the movie." And so each time we cast someone, or we offered, because we offered it to Henry, we offered it to Calm Fiore, and of course, thank God they were so generous, they said yes. I would put the call in to welcome them to the show, and Calm only had one day, and it was a monster day. Like, I think he had 12 pages all in, interspersed throughout the whole script, and it was a 14-hour day. And I remember calling him. He was working on that. He was working on Anon with Andrew Nichols' movie for Netflix. Kiwi, yeah. And I called him up, and what he didn't realize, but I ended up telling him, was that when I was 14, I was lucky enough to go to Stratford Shakespeare. Stratford, Canada, and to watch the Shakespeare Festival, and he played Richard III, and his Richard III was transformative in my life as an actor. And I was just like, because I was a big theater nerd back in, I think it was 88, and I just was like, oh my God, Calm Fiore. And ever since then, he's always been associated with this great role. So when I called him up, I'm like, oh my God, I just got to tell you, your Richard III was transformative. It was the greatest thing I've ever seen. And I think it was because of that I decided that I wanted to be an actor, and I ended up becoming an actor. And I just wanted to say thank you so much. And then I hung up the phone, not sort of welcoming him to the thing. And he calls me back and he goes, so did you want to talk about the script? Or? And I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Yeah, thank you. And he was just lovely. So yeah, and we shot it in August, and now it's finally coming out.
Well, tell us a little bit about it, because I think what's interesting, it kind of revolves around urban legend, mm-hmm. right? And I think we all, at least I have a similar urban legend to this in Long Island. So can you talk a little bit about that? Was that one of the original elements from the original scripts, or did you pull from your own personal urban legend stories?
Well, so Buckout Road is a 2-mile stretch of road in Westchester, New York.
Yeah.
It connects Westchester to White Plains, and it is considered to be the most haunted road in America. Hmm. It is home to 13 urban legends, including the call is coming from inside the house that originated from one of the houses there. Pull up to the old dilapidated house, honk your horn 3 times, and albinos will come out and eat you. There's been a variation of those.
I didn't know that one. I like that.
I'm not aware of this one.
But there are variations of that, pulling up, honking the horn.
Why are they albinos?
I don't know. but the most famous two of the most famous things is Albert Fisk lived there. Yeah. Oh, wow. Off Buckout Road, and it was the
that
only,
would be enough.
Well, it was the only place
wearing kids' heads.
It was the only place in America where it was purported that witches were burned at the stake. So when people associate witches being burned at the stake, no witch was burned at the stake in America.
Yeah, they always think Salem that happened, but it never happened.
Yeah, it didn't. It happened in Buckout Road, just off of Buckout Road. So it's always had this perpetuated.
That's documented or just a?
Yeah, it's totally documented. It's an urban legend. Okay. So, I don't know.
It's like a creepy
I don't know how well you'd be
documented.
It's documented. My best friend's boyfriend's sister told me
totally,
about
it. Because we were driving Elvis's motorcycle, and Eddie Murphy was in the elevator, and he said they burned witches on Buckout Road. So it was home to all these urban legends. The Leather Man is another one, where there was a homeless man in the 1800s wandering around. And Pearl Jam actually wrote a song called The Leather Man based on this.
What was he doing?
This urban legend.
He's just walking around. That's all you got to.
I assume he's wearing skin.
It's not a horror thing. Although he has no teeth. His jaw was missing. He's horrific. And people would leave food out for him, and then he would just kind of come out.
Why did they call him the Leather Man?
Because he wore skins and leather. He did. But when you say skins, I go to,
Leatherface. Which is why.
That's not it. So people would leave food for him, and he would take the food and then go back. And he would just wander. It was a 300-mile circumference that he would wander over the course twice a year. and he would just kind of come in and out. And Pearl Jam wrote a song. So Buckout Road, for people who live in Westchester and White Plains, it's a sacred, like, they're like, don't fuck with this. So when I went into this, I did just exhaustive research to make sure that I could. Now, obviously, I couldn't do a movie with 13 urban legends in it. It would be, you know, 12 hours long. So I kind of took four urban legends, combined them into one, and then I did sort of three main stories where the three urban legends. And so far, the response from the people there have been like really, really positive.
Did you screen it there?
Yeah, we screened it twice there. We did two sold out screenings in Yonkers and in White Plains, during our festival run, just to sort of say thank you. And they fucking loved it. So
what was the main urban legend that you leaned on?
There's two. One is a conduit, which is the lady in white that she has a lantern and she kind of guides you to your death, which is sort of something that I wrote in. The lady in white in the original Buckeye Road urban legend just appeared. There's never any closure in these urban legends. Like, look, there's a lady in white and that's it. Well, now she leads you to your death. And the other one was the witches burning at the stake.
Were
the two. And the cannibal. Actually, there was three main ones. When you see the film, what we did is it all takes place in kind of a dream. I pitched sort of a Dream Warriors angle where it was like,
so surprising coming from you.
Yeah, right? I know.
Given other scripts you've written.
Listen, if you've ever read any, so for those of you who want to read my, everyone who's ever read any of my things, PTSD and fucking dreams and anything to do with the mind and insanity is.
Hey, wait, I shot that teaser.
You did. It's all in there. It's all I write about. So what I thought would be fun was that the angle that I took was that the nemesis for the devil is not God. It's an atheist. So if these people were to debunk urban legends and say none of this is true, it's kind of like science doesn't give a shit what you believe in. It's going to prove you wrong.
Oh, like Nightbreed has that angle a bit. Like if we don't believe in the monsters, then they just exist.
Yeah. So we say, you know, the whole idea is that these three college kids debunk the urban legends of Buckout Road and say none of this is real. Witches weren't burned here. You know, albinism, there's one in 660,000 people and two in the same family. Come on. You know, but Buckout Road, what they come to realize is sort of a hellmouth where evil doesn't give a fuck whether you don't believe it or not, it's going to get you in the end. And the way we get them is that the lady in white guides them in their dreams and they relive the trauma that's in like the Buckhead Road urban legend. So the albinos come out and eat you or the
–
Do you actually
have albinos on this?
We do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, you haven't seen it.
I saw a very early cut like a while ago.
Yeah.
And I know it's changed a lot and I had no memory of albinos.
Well, it's because we didn't have the special effects with the red eyes yet. So once you've seen the completed picture, you'll see we've whitened their faces.
Are they cannibal albinos?
Of course. Okay. Is there any other kind? So, yes.
I kind of just wanted him to approach the car and be like, my name's Harold. Are you lost?
Yeah, hey, what's going on? Oh, please don't shine that light at me. I'm very photosensitive. So we try to – everything sort of happens in the dream and then, you know, bad shit happens and then there's a twist that I'm not going to – you guys can go see it.
Spoil it.
I won't spoil it.
We will not.
So this is September 27th is when this will be in theaters and VOD. Day and date?
Yeah, day and date. It's coming out on digital HD and VOD September 27th. And in Canada, for all our Canadian friends, it is playing a double feature with Black Christmas.
Ooh.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's in Canada. Unfortunately, we couldn't get the first run theaters because they don't do day and date. You have to have like a 9-week window. Because we're doing a day and date, and because the production company who shot Buckout Road also owns the rights to Black Christmas, we've decided to do
pretty cool.
Some of the fun. Yeah, we decided. It's funny. John, my producer, is amazing. Called me up. And I love that he has all these really great ideas. But what I love the most, which by the way, filmmakers, I just want to put a shout out there to filmmakers. I know you're always being vetted by producers, but you can vet producers. And if you can, just work with fucking decent people. Yeah. And just never not work with them. Like, John has no reason to call me up and ask my opinion and say, like, he calls me up. He's like, do you think it would be fun if we did a Buckout Road, the Curse of Buckout Road and Black Christmas? I'm like, yeah, that's a great idea. Like, you don't need my permission. He's like, yeah, but it's a courtesy, you know? It's your movie and I want to support you. I'm like, Fuck, man.
How Canadian is that?
He's so Canadian. So if you, if you're across Canada for the most of October, actually, it'll be playing various cities across Canada in the Repertory Cinemas with Black Christmas, double feature.
Nice. That's freaking awesome.
I'm super excited about that.
Wow. So lots to listen to and watch. And for the three of you, because obviously for a lot of people that listen, their favorite part is listening to what we've seen lately, our first part of it. All three of you, anything recently within the genre that you've seen, loved, reacted to, or just in general, like how do you get ready for the Halloween season?
Oh, well, I've been getting ready since July. I've been living Halloween nonstop for the past 2 months, making my family insane. But I've been watching a lot of Satanic Panic lately, that's for sure.
How many times have you seen it?
I've actually only seen it a couple times now. I haven't been going completely overboard. Yeah. But I am currently teaching a genre writing class, and so at a school with one of the hosts
here. Two of the people.
Hey,
two of the
people. I'm there too.
Two of the people here. And I hit a wonderfully horrific realization yesterday in class that none of my students had ever seen They Live.
Oh, my gosh.
Which
criminal.
I just watched the night before.
I point out right now that the students who are of this age now, I just figured this out the other day, are born after The Matrix.
Yep.
So if that point, and we're talking about 19, 20 year olds. And that's post-Matrix. You have BC, but now we have post-Matrix. That blows my mind.
And so I watched it before the class to prep. And honestly, seen the movie a million times, right?
Yeah.
It's something that we love to death. And watching it this time was different. Watching Roddy Piper all of a sudden just pick up a gun and walk into a room and start shooting people, like completely unannounced, all of a sudden felt more impactful. I was kind of shocked that I had a bigger, more visceral reaction to it this time than, the other 1,000 times I've seen this film, which was really weird because I don't consciously put that in my head. But as an educator now, you do get trained. You get told about, active shooter drills and stuff like that. And with my kid, and so I'm watching it with my son, and both of us had that same reaction watching it. And Clayton had seen it a bunch of times. And so we're sitting there watching it and going, wow, this is really violent, isn't it? This is like a little shockingly violent, isn't it? And Clay's like, yeah, it was very strange. I felt like that movie changed for me. And it's been a long time since a older movie has changed for me. And so that was a big one this week. I thought that was really neat.
Wow. Interesting.
Have you shown it to the students yet?
I did not show them that scene because, students are sensitive, and if I don't warn them before triggering, then I'm going to get fired.
Yep.
But
not by me.
Not by you.
I will be fired before you on
but
that.
But you showed them the 10-minute fight.
I showed them. No, I didn't. I showed them from the moment he puts the glasses on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very long segment of watching that all the way through the scene in up until he's about to go into the bank and shoot people. Just because I wanted them to see the visual representation of this alternate reality and how it's an excellent metaphor for ideology.
It's brilliant. It's one of the best satire sequences that you're talking about.
Yeah. And context is really important. If you don't just walk into
it's like a shooting scene.
I'm just here. We go, bubblegum and ass kicking.
Yeah. I mean, it does play very much like any workplace shooting film. Yeah. The way he just sort of kicks the door in is like, and I'm here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. It's kind of insanely shocking now.
Wow. But you could also look at the whole movie at the lens. Yeah. If you took away the visions that we're seeing, he would just seem like a complete paranoid. Keith David thinks he is.
Yeah. Exactly.
Keith David thinks he's out of his mind, right?
I was sympathizing with Keith David much more this time than I ever had. Because of that.
That's a whole different read, that Roddy Piper is just fucking nuts, but that's the perspective we're getting.
Yeah. Is there an edit where we just take out him, his glasses view, and what would that movie play like?
And he's just,
a guy with sunglasses coming in shooting people.
God told me to psychopath.
Yeah, right after they sort of, right after they bulldoze the homeless community and torch the church, he just goes and starts shooting shit up. Like, that's what would happen.
I'd watch that.
I mean, it would play.
That's what hit me last time. It was actually a jump go. We watched it on 16mm.
Oh,
must have been Mike. And I had the first 20 minutes, I was watching it going, Jesus Christ, this is a neorealist film. This is like this Rossellini movie. It's all like working class guys work. And I was like, this is the ultimate one percenter movie. Like this is a movie about like the haves and have-nots.
And we talked about it on Killer POV because I remember calling it the bicycle thief horror movie.
It really
movie.
Felt like
it,
that.
It really, I mean.
Until the body slam.
No, yeah, it changed the alley. But, for 12 minutes.
But up till that. It's like, this is the longest fight ever.
As a kid, I even understood that.
With like 2x4s. Like
yeah. Up to that point, it's about the plight of the working homeless.
Yeah.
You know, it's about people who have jobs and no place to live. It's a really powerful film on every level still, and plus, you know, 7-minute fist fight is fucking glorious.
Yeah. You know, the door is really wide open right now for something with that same kind of social context and quality of the working homeless, especially in LA where we have such a massive problem with it. Like that movie feels more topical now than ever in that.
Absolutely. Those were a bunch of little, there are a lot of little elements in it that felt really resonant. And so I was really happy to have rewatched that lately.
Wow. You know what I discovered that none of my students have seen? I'm showing it next week. In my story construction class, the story, I don't even remember what the technical name of the class is. I'm teaching a story class.
but it's all about
building stories.
I don't have to explain how it's done. I just got to let you know that it
I'm
going
to tell you how to do it, but I don't know the name of the class or anything. Yeah. I think it's called Story Lab, which
story is. Story mediums and genres.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Story mediums and
that's
genres.
That's why I run this thing.
Becca, don't make me regret hiring
stories.
You.
But that said, I was going to show a feature to have them break down, you know, the actual three act structure and when new information is released and character arcs within each act and then as a whole. And I'd planned to show Jaws because I consider it to be perfect. And a couple of the students had seen it. So I went through a list of like three other films. Out of 40 students, one had seen Fargo. One.
No, wow, that's
so guess
criminal.
What we're watching on Monday?
You know, Jaws? It's actually awesome, though. Like, that's what I love about it. Yeah. You have a generation who are like blank sponges, and their minds are freaking blown by some of these movies.
Dude, I have a 13-year-old daughter, and let me tell you, she's just – it's so great introducing her to things like – I was watching Collateral last night. Yeah. I've been on a Michael Mann kick. I watched the Heat and or not the Heat. I watched the movie The Heat. I watched The Heat and no, because I had watched The Hidden and I conflated the two, which that would be a good crossover.
Yeah.
Collateral.
Michael Mann's The Hidden.
Awesome.
Yes, please.
No, but I watched Collateral and my daughter walked in and she was just kind of going, oh, I don't see movies of this style, like the neo-noir type. You know, the way it's shot.
That's all at night.
And I'm like, there's a whole shit ton of stuff that you know nothing about, like subgenres, just even genres. Like she's seen a couple noir films because I'm a big film noir fan, but like the neo-noir stuff, the 70s thrillers. And she saw True Romance for the first time. Mm-hmm. And now we're going, okay, where are we going to go with Tarantino now? You know, like what are we going to see? And to know that, you know, this 13-year-old kid is just who's into film.
Yeah.
Suddenly is about to see shit that's going to blow her mind is the most exciting thing for me.
Yeah.
Well, Elric, you told me you showed your students last year Cronenberg's The Fly.
Yeah, I showed it on Valentine's Day and you know, positioned it as like this great romance. Not a single one had seen it. And they were all blown away. I showed after she asked this thing about Fargo yesterday. In my class, I do an aesthetics class, so intro to like film language. And I showed Blood Simple for lighting, composition, frame. And it's the most perfect movie. It's my favorite of all their movies now. And I'm like, that's crazy given how good they are that their first film is that good. I've watched it every year for about 4 years of teaching. And every time I watch it, I sit there and I'm like the most enraptured. I'm just watching this thing going, how the fuck did they? And M. Emmett Walsh in that movie.
Is perfect. He is just greasy.
So good. But it is exciting. Wonderful. And when you see young people's wheels turn, because again, I think what we're at, and this is something, you know, talk about on the other show, curation now and kind of anything we do is never been more important because we are if there's going to be a death of cinema, it's going to be because people don't go beyond Netflix. They will.
Yeah.
But if you go to Netflix, there's nothing there anymore.
Yeah. Nothing old.
Besides originals.
New
yeah.
Originals.
And so if you're and Amazon Prime is great because it's so random. But like a lot of the young people, when I have conversations with them, that is really, they go, if it's on Netflix, I watch it. If it's not. And you're just like, oh my God, you guys are not seeing 99.9% of cinema.
There are some students in the horror class.
Oh, and I
have
some
students at USC in the horror class there as well that do have Shudder. So I will give mad props to Shudder because they are finding stuff through Shudder.
And they are curious. curating. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It really matters. Like Criterion, like the Criterion Channel. I love Filmstruck was great, but it's somebody saying, no, look over here. And if you're interested in that, now look over here. And I think, I don't know if it's work ethic. Like I know when I was in film school, I'd be in a class, I'd see a Fassbender film, and I would go to the library they had and I would watch 12 Fassbender films. And I did that. They didn't make me, you can't get given an education of this shit, right? You mm-hmm. have to have the fire. And I think one thing I've noticed is a lot of people just don't have that same ability to find that resource anymore.
Since the death of the video store. Yeah. Because the video store I worked at a video store for six years and we just threw everything in there and you just be like, all right, have at her. Whereas now you're right. It's curated and it's algorithmed.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it's like suddenly, oh, you like this. You must like 17 of these. I'm like, actually, I didn't like any of those.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
But Elric, we still need to do that double feature of Blood Simple and Psycho 3. Remember?
Yeah.
Wait, what was the connection there again?
Well, no, because Perkins it was like his favorite movie at the time. And so actually made them all, the whole cast and crew, watch Blood Simple before they started Psycho 3. He got Carter Burwell to do the score. And the last time I saw Psycho 3, the color, the dark humor of it, even the music, I'm like, holy shit, he's trying to make Blood Simple.
I have a crazy appreciation for Psycho
the original Psycho.
Oh, Psycho 3 is great.
Psycho 3
is
great.
But no, so I always wanted to do a double feature of the two of them because the last time I watched them both, I'm like, these are really similar in tone.
Mm. There's, and just for good podcast recommendation, Gilbert Gottfried, who has this crazy show.
Oh, yeah.
It's Amazing fun. Podcast.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those I don't listen to all the time because he's such a character, but they're pretty good interviews. They get M. Emmett Walsh from, this is like last year. I didn't even know he's still alive. I really didn't. I was like, oh, wow, he's still alive. And when they talk about Blood Simple, it's hilarious. He, you know, people forget. No one knew who the Coen brothers. They just seemed like two goofy kids, and he did not believe it was a real movie, even when he went down there to film. It's like he couldn't take it seriously, didn't know if it was going to be a real thing, like was skeptical all the way through shooting. So you always forget when you see something that polished. Yeah, Raimi was friends with them, and Francis McDormand. They'd all just met. So it's a birth of a very interesting period. Yeah, it's crazy. Anyway, that's definitely, now we're doing pure cinema, guys.
We can bring it back to horror.
Back to horror.
I consider Pure Blood Simple to be a horror.
It's
movie.
Really?
It
actually has got a couple moments that are straight horror. There's a couple of things with Dan Hedaya halfway through that are actually like going back to a horror beat for sure. Yeah. I agree with that.
The knife in the hand always gets me. I'm always.
It's brilliant. But it's a film about not communicating. It's like if you don't communicate straight, this is what happens. It all goes bad. And that's what the Coen brothers are so smart about.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah,
but horror.
Horror.
Oh, horror. So, I mean, there was it chapter two. Yeah, I wrote them all down. Tigers Are Not Afraid, Satanic Panic, which I really enjoyed.
I loved seeing your daughter there. That was just so cool.
That was pretty fun. I think for my pick, I mean, have we done the whole Tigers Are Not Afraid thing?
We've talked about it. It was my number one 2 years ago, and it's going to make my top 10 list again because that's how long it's taken to come out.
We haven't really talked about it because we know we've written to Issa, and we assume she's going to come on the show in a month
or something. But it's on Shudder now.
Yeah, it's on Shudder.
I just watched it. I thought it was pretty strong, but I'm curious about what everyone's thought of it. Chapter two was.
We liked it.
Because I fucking loved it. I haven't seen it. I loved it.
It's funnier than it is scary, but it's really heartfelt and it's a really good, it's fun movie. And,
we all liked it. Because everyone I'm talking to says it's terrible. I'm like,
if it's all the people who saw it opening night and then it had all this negative buzz and then anyone who waited a little longer, it seems to tone down and your expectations change. And then I was like, this is fun.
Dude, I saw it opening night. I thought it was the most fun I've had in a movie in
Bill Hader is.
Bill Hader, dude.
Yeah, but we can't spoil it for these two. Are gonna kill us.
Okay.
No, but somebody has.
So Tigers Are Not Afraid is really strong.
Yeah,
I think the It Chapter Two thing. The problem is people are saying, "Oh, it's not as scary as the first one." Well, because adults versus children, it's just that simple. Yeah. And yes, there's an opening beat to It Chapter Two that sort of subverts horror and pushes it to something else, but. There is a scare in that movie that made the hair on my arm stand up, that made me sort of cringe because I don't get scared in movies anymore. I'm a little bit beyond it. I'm 50 fucking years old and I've seen just about everything. But there is a certain type of scare that it got me so good that I was like, okay, this scene can be over now. Like I was starting to cower up the back of my chair a little bit and I was kind of freaked out. So fucking bravo.
To that, what I liked about It Chapter Two really quickly was that, and I want to speak to that kind of a moment in a movie that you don't see anymore. And I can bring it back to another horror movie that came out. But the cool thing with what I liked about It Chapter Two, and I'm not ruining anything for those who haven't seen it, is that you have adults, but they're given kiddie scares. Like they're given the scares that they would get with a kid. So there's this level of absurdity because you're a grown up and then suddenly there's a something that would scare a kid, like a grotesquerie that you're just kind of going, oh, if I was 12, this would be terrifying. And as an adult, you're just kind of going, that is fucked up.
No, but somebody had described it to me as Big Chill with a killer clown. And that to me was like the biggest moment for it, because it is. It's adults dealing with adult problems and then shoved back into this like nightmarish bullshit from their childhood.
But it's all like
what I don't understand.
What I don't understand is like how can anyone love fantasy horror like any of the Nightmare on Elm Streets? And then rag on this. It's like,
well, that's what it feels close.
This is a fucking gift. It's like every time, but every time we saw, like when I saw Nightmare on Elm Street, I think by the time I saw it in the theater, it was like up to 4 was the first one I saw. And then, you know, the rest of them, every horror fan, as we grow up going, oh, could you imagine if like Hollywood just gave a shit ton of money to make a real Freddy, like a, and then that's what it is. It's like you just watch this going, you just fucking spent $100 million on this insanity shit.
I've never once thought about like any – I've never seen a film where I'm like, oh, that guy should remake Nightmare on Elm Street. This is the first time I walked out of saying, going, if anyone ever does it, I think this guy could
do
it. And I haven't ever thought that.
But to your point, I just wanted to touch on what you talked about, a scene that brought the hair on your skin stand up on. And have you guys seen Ready or Not yet?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I say that yet. Like, of course you guys have seen it. I'm a dad, so I'm like the last guy to see it. That scene where she's in the fucking pit of bodies and the only way that she can get out is because she has a hole in her hand.
Yeah.
I have and having seen that, the movie was fun. I had a really good time. But seeing something like that, I'm like, yes. And as a filmmaker, if I can do one or two things that I've never seen before that are kind of fun – like, then you win. And I thought, like, for that one moment.
That was literally the moment I got invested in the movie. I was kind of like on the fringe because it was a little too broad for me. Like, the humor, like, I was like, oh, if you played it a little more real, I probably would have been even more into this concept. But the moment that part, the tone changes so dramatically. Mm-hmm. And I'm with you. Once it gets visceral, I'm drawn in.
And I'd never seen that before. I'd never seen, you know, stigmata used to help you get out of a horrible situation by, like, you know, impaling the hole in your hand
also,
onto
she's
a
just
spike.
Great. She's really great in that.
I haven't seen it yet. Thanks.
Oh, sorry. It's one scene.
No.
What do you bring to the table right now?
I was just about to say, like, I haven't really seen a whole bunch of horror because my wife and I had a daughter 6 months ago.
Hey, mazel tov.
Congratulations.
So that is.
So your life is pure horror.
Is that your first?
That is a horror in itself. And
is it your first?
Yes.
Do they have baby screenings over there? Like, so we have.
Oh, so we can. Yes.
So, and by the way, that became a controversy this week because somebody alerted somebody and said, look, they're doing these baby screenings of It too. Yeah. And they were like, how does
this
work?
It's a fucking baby.
I know. But this, I took
baby
Marnie.
Doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. I took Marnie to see, it was one of the new Resident Evil films. And all it is, they play it at like 10
in the morning.
That's
actually fucking child abuse, dude.
She didn't take Marnie like yesterday.
Yesterday. I'm talking like she was like maybe 5 weeks old.
Right.
I mean, I fucking watched The New Maniac with you two and my like 5 week old daughter in my living room.
Oh, really?
It
reminded me of when my daughter was born, and I would like when she was like just like 5 weeks old, I would watch like The Hills Have Eyes remake, like just all these movies because, you know, my wife needed to sleep.
Yeah.
So I was like, all
right.
And they're
not absorbing anything.
They're not looking at this going, it's kind of fucked up. And I think I like the Wes Craven version better. Yeah. You know, they're just there.
Justify however you want.
But yeah, so the baby screenings I loved because it was like 10 a.m. They turn the volume down a little bit.
The lights are up a bit.
Yeah.
Too.
And if your kid starts crying, it's totally fine because everybody else in there has a kid too.
Yeah. I haven't done that yet. I may look into that, but I've, it's been very light for me on horror. I purposely took myself to the theater to see one film. I took time away from my wife and my daughter, and I regretted it immensely.
Oh, no.
I know where he's going
I'm not
going
to say what it is because we don't besmirch on this podcast or the podcast I host as well. But I did watch.
Can you write it down? And
yeah, I can. Oh, okay, well, I can tell you. It was,
how about I say the name and you just nod? The Palmer. Yep, I knew I'd get that one.
What was it? I missed it. What did he say?
Midsommar.
Oh, God.
I understand that film is for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I get it. It's just not for me.
Right, it's definitely a hit or miss thing for some people.
I think Cobra is a fucking awesome film.
If they ate pizza like that in Midsommar,
there you go.
It'd be even better.
Wait, Cobra? Are you kidding? They have a spark factory in Cobra. Cobra's the greatest movie of all time.
Satanic cult, Stallone, Bridget. I mean, what's not to love?
It's perfect.
It is. And this morning, because I'm still kind of jet-lagged, I wake up at 4 4 o'clock in the morning, and as a parent, you don't need sleep anymore. You just, yeah. You're awake. I watched Under the Silver Lake, which I know isn't strictly really a horror film, but I loved It Follows, and I figured, I'll watch this, and I'm not quite sure if it was good or bad.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
I have no idea. It's like I have to watch it again.
Yeah.
Only because I have no idea if that's terrible. Well, I know it's not terrible. It's interesting.
Yeah.
And I know some scenes are great, but then it could also just not work at all.
There were parts of it that just flat out confused me.
Do you know whose favorite film of the year it is? Quentin Tarantino.
Of course it is.
Of course. I was listening to him, and he slammed him for It Follows.
I don't know. Well, he slammed him about some of the rules. But I was listening to an interview with Amy Nichols, and he's just like, yeah, relax, film it. I was just listening going,
I think I will watch it again.
Yeah. Somebody told me it's
like – you like parts of it.
See, somebody told me it's like Southland Tales, and I have a strange love only of Southland Tales.
Only in the idea of how it's made.
Yes.
Like carte blanche to make a movie. It's way too long, way too – but it's more – yeah, Hipster Hitchcock is the best description.
I kind of like it.
I did think the length was odd because I'd watched what felt like 3 hours and I paused it and I text Rob and I looked up and noticed there was almost an hour and a half left.
Yeah.
I just thought, what
it's an
else
interesting,
can
yeah.
possibly
I'm with you.
Happen?
Because so, lots of, it closes a narrative and then opens
and
a whole
then
new
a
narrative.
Whole
and
other
like,
thing
what?
Happens.
Well,
it's very strange.
I think I've checked the time meter while we were watching it and I was like, all right, there's another hour and a half.
Yeah,
and you're like, I don't know where we're going.
No,
I have no idea.
Of course, we started with the pig fucking movie, so we could have gone anywhere.
He gets sprayed. When he gets sprayed with a skunk, you're like, wait, what?
That completely.
It's from Belgium, Sean. Sean gave me a look. It's from Belgium.
That part lost me.
Here's the abbreviated version of the pickfucking story because it's kind of funny. So we had Joe Bob Briggs on the show two years ago at
Chattanooga.
And the question was, what's the most screwed up thing you've ever seen? And he's like, well, there's some movie from Belgium, which is like a pig fucking movie or something like that. Yeah. He just mentioned it on the show. And then a month later, I get home and some company from Europe is like, we put that out on DVD. Do you want
it? Wasn't me.
They sent copies to all of us.
I'm like, sure. All right. So they sent it. And then finally, we watch it because we're going to do another show with Joe Bob. We're like, oh, it's a year later. Elric and I should watch it. We watched like 15, 20 minutes before we got really uncomfortable.
We made sure we went up to the pig fucking. And once I'm saying, wait, what is that? Is that a pig vagina? And he's like, no, it's not. And then something comes out and we're like, oh shit, it is.
Oh,
anyway,
that's
it was
a birth.
Bad.
Anyway, so we stopped it there. Yeah. Then we do the show with Joe Bob, which first of all, I was like, didn't we do this last year? He's like, why am I talking to you again? And we're like, all right, no.
It's because we've seen it now.
Well, yeah. And we brought it up and he's like, I didn't tell you to see it. I said it was the most screwed up thing I saw. I wasn't recommending
it.
It's not an endorsement.
But I'm with you with Midsommar. Like,
I
I'm with you when you say it's – you can't deny that it's not well made. Like the
It's a well made film. But I've seen commercials that are well made.
I just – you know, but I felt completely disengaged.
I don't know if it's – I wasn't a huge fan of Hereditary. I thought the first half of Hereditary would – sitting in the theater, I thought, I'm watching something that could rival The Shining. I was completely blown away. And then it just turned into, okay. Yeah, okay. And it, just for Midsommar, I really like the score. I think Bobby's score is really good. And I will say this, I haven't watched a lot, but I've heard something I think you guys are going to love, which is Fabio Fritzi has remade the Beyond
score.
Oh,
my God. Oh, wow. When's it on sale officially?
That's a good question.
Wait, why would he redo the score?
Because there was a lot left out.
Oh.
So Fabio's been touring this thing called the Composer's Cut for a few years. He's done it here and he's done it in Europe as well. And this record label, Kadabra Records, that mainly focuses on spoken word and weird fiction. So H.P. Lovecraft, Poe, things like that. They have worked together and Fabio basically had found these notes from back in 80, whenever the film was. And he decided he was going to make his version of The Beyond musically. So he's made this new version. It runs for over an hour and it's amazing. It's if you like the music in the Beyond, you're gonna love this because it's all brand new recordings. His band now are phenomenal, and I heard that recently, and it just I've listened to it a couple of times, and it's absolutely amazing. It's really good, and it takes you. I mean, it's if you know the score and if you're familiar with the film, you'll love it. But there are new things that you're just like, wow, what would that have been like in the film back then? So I highly recommend that. I think it's on pre-sale now, maybe.
I'm trying to look it up because I saw there was a lot of excitement about it at MondoCon.
It goes on pre-sale tomorrow, the 19th. There you go.
Okay.
Sorry, but by the time you're hearing it's on sale. Yeah, there you go. So yeah, I wanted to talk about that because it's really good as well. You know, there are tons of horror records out there at the moment, horror scores and things like that, but that is something I would recommend.
And I think we saw him do it at Beyond. Was it last year?
I thought he did House.
I saw him play to Inferno, or was that?
No, that's Goblin.
No, wait, that was Goblin. Did that? You're right.
No, he came out and did the composer cut.
He's done that
to the Beyond at Beyond Fest.
Wow,
I'm pretty sure.
I think he played it to a whole bunch of clips of his movies.
Like that's the Fritzy to Fulci show.
Yeah, I went to that.
So that one's pretty cool. But he does the Beyond as well. Yeah, so you just watch the movie with no soundtrack.
Yeah, no, I've seen that one because as I was telling Tony before we were on air was that. Because it's a Grindhouse releasing, Bob Murawski puts it out. And what was great about it is sometimes you see live scores to movies and the music is in the movie. So it's a little awkward because you're hearing music and music. But because Murawski owns the Beyond, the version that he made was like a 4K version that he pulled the audio out. Mm-hmm. So it's all the dialogue. And so the only score was
the live score.
The live score.
Nice.
That's awesome.
And so it actually was one of the perfect balances of it. And it was actually incredible. And I know you didn't get a chance to see Evil Dead, but I have a sneaky suspicion that's what the new Evil Dead is because again, it's another Grindhouse releasing. So I wouldn't be surprised if Murawski pulled the audio out and this new Joe.
I almost saw the Evil Dead rescore at MondoCon.
I was
this close to Joe LaDuca.
Yeah.
But I fell asleep.
And they're doing it Beyond Fest, but I didn't get a chance.
Yes, they are. But the new score is available as well. The score that he's redone, you can already buy now from Mondo.
Yeah, that was Mondo.
Yes. Yeah, that's out. And that's good too. So, you know, if you're into that stuff.
Well, you'd fit in more movies if the two you didn't watch weren't 3 hours each. So you're making weird life choices.
Yeah.
You know, when my daughter
he's getting
was,
his money's worth.
Yeah, well, that's it. When my daughter was first born, she was awake all these crazy hours, and I was just watching anything on Amazon Prime, and I ended up watching one of the last Transformers movies, movies officially died that day for me. I was like, that's it. I'm just going to watch TV. So I did watch recently, it was kind of horrific in a way, the second season of that show on Netflix that Mindhunter.
Oh, it's great.
That's awesome. Yeah, tons of horror stuff in there. So, that's good too.
It's a tight one.
Cool. Well, that's Halloween started. I think we're launching it right with good people.
Halloween has started, guys.
Remind them, so is Bandcamp the only place we can find the album?
Yeah, the only place you can get the album Killer Sounds of Halloween is on Bandcamp right now. Go grab it.
And tell people about it if you dig it. Like I think this sounds like it's something you have to share to get it.
I mean, it's the thing to play at your Halloween party. It is a mixtape, novelty songs, rock and roll tunes, all kinds of stuff. It's some silly fun. 13,
and it's really good.
13 original songs by 13 fake bands with a bunch of phony shit in between.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. And we're going to close out with My Halloween Queen, which is the second track you sent. Cool. Anything you want to say about this?
Yeah. This one, the fake band is Los Hombres Duendos, which is Spanish for the Elf Men, because this is my Oingo Boingo ripoff track.
I thought it was like the band that's in From Dusk Till Dawn. Like
Tito and the Tarantulas.
I was like, oh, it sounds like that band.
It had a little bit of that, too. That's why I put that name on it. And with Graham Skipper, the amazing, talented actor, singer, just kicking an ass on this.
That's awesome. So we're gonna play out with that. Thank you Tony Giles for being in town and dropping by. Sean Keller, of course. Matthew Curry Holmes and your movie September 27th, The Curse of Buckeye Road, to check that out
on VOD.
On VOD, yeah. And we're also releasing the soundtrack. So
cool.
Ryan Shore is releasing the soundtrack digitally. So.
Oh, great.
As you were talking.
From which label?
Well, I think I'm not quite sure. He actually went to Mondo to get the vinyl, but unfortunately Mondo passed. So but we should talk.
We should talk.
because he really wants to do a vinyl release.
Okay.
And cool. I can connect you guys.
We can talk.
I love that.
Yeah. All right.
Yes, Curse of Buckeye Road, September 27th. Thanks.
Beautiful. Thank you guys. And this is it. Halloween season is upon us.
Woo-hoo. Yes.
All right. Happy Halloween.
Kick it off, buddy.
Late at night, she creeps in bed and says, give me love, give me blood, give me head. A quiver and a quake down in my bones. I got nowhere left, she's in control. Ever did see. She's my sweet evil dream, my Halloween queen. She cuts and she kisses and she claws and she bites. And she makes me bow down on Halloween. dream, my Halloween queen. My Halloween queen, she's my everything. With lips that burn and eyes that sting. When the dead start dancing and the demons sing, well, she's the queen of a dream. And in your arms every night is Halloween. Soaring on the edge of endless night. When the full moon glows and the owls take flight. She's my sweet evil dream, my Halloween queen. Yeah, baby. Put those icy hands around my throat and squeeze.